But then we didn't have a match on Raw for about a month. And then we finally got a match, but we lost the titles and we never got a rematch. And you hear that music? That's the most generic music I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, Zachary. Come on, man. We're different, okay? We can't be like every other WWE superstar and just complain.
Bro, I was about to go on Twitter and complain right now.
Well, no. You gotta remember. The 80s rock and wrestling era, that's gone. And the Attitude Era, that's certainly gone. And believe it or not, the Ruthless Aggression Era has passed us by too. But instead, we're going to invite all of you to go on a journey with us. Take a journey with Hawkins and Ryder to the Gratitude Era.
I love it. No more complaining. The Gratitude Era. Say it with us. Gratitude. Gratitude. Gratitude.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly.
Woo! I am a one-man wrecking crew.
The Gratitude Era. They have these guys come out during commercial break on Raw last Monday and talk about all of the other talent that complains online. You shouldn't complain online. This is the Gratitude Era. Jesus Christ. Oh my God. Well, I hope everybody on the West Coast is okay after those earthquakes and that John Tenta didn't do too much damage. And I hope everybody had a happy 4th of July. Didn't blow off any fingers with any Roman candles. The Mets, unfortunately, did not escape the holiday unscathed, or should I say their minor league team in St. Lucie did not. They set fire to their own stadium in a botched fireworks display, or may have been a little area next to the stadium, but this is not even the first time that it's happened. 2 years ago, at the same stadium, the same team, a big brush fire broke out. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. Which reminded me that a fire broke out. I was thinking about this. There was a fire that broke out at Citi Field, the place where the Mets play, last year. The Mets were away. They weren't even there. They weren't even playing that day. They were on the road, and I don't know what happened, but there was video that somebody shot with their phone. You can look right through the front gate, and there was a display case in the rotunda by the main entrance that caught fire, and this thing was just completely engulfed in flames, sort of like their season this year. So they are on a roll, this team is. They had a celebration of their championship team from 1969 last week. The Mets don't have too many championships, for those of you who don't know the history of the organization. There were the Miracle Mets in 1969. They did not win another World Series until 1986, and they have not won one since. And it's kind of shocking to think about where this organization and where this team is now. Because it was only 4 years ago that they were in the World Series. And there was a lot of hope. And there was a lot of optimism. Of course, that got snuffed out. But they had a celebration. The 50-year anniversary celebration of the 69 Mets. And they aired a remembrance montage during the pregame ceremony that day to remember those team members who are no longer with us. Because there's a lot of Mets from 1969. It's a long time ago. Who have since passed on. Only problem is, they killed two members of the team who were still very much alive. These two guys, Jim Gosker and Jesse Hudson. Gosker did a round of interviews later on. He said, "Can't they Google me and see that I'm still around?" Yeah, that's a pretty good question. Apparently not. Maybe their records burned up in that last fire and they didn't know. Then they made news again in the last 24 hours for their general manager throwing a chair in a meeting with the team's coaching staff. He picked up a chair and he threw it across the room and he told his manager to conduct his, and I quote, "fucking press conference." So things are going well. This, of course, after the manager threatened a newspaper writer. I talked about this before. This was a few weeks ago. He threatened the newspaper writer who had the gall, who had the audacity when he saw that the manager had gotten dressed and he was leaving to say to the guy, see you tomorrow. This, of course, was after another just terrible Mets loss, and I'm sure the manager was not in a very good mood. He said, see you tomorrow. And he threatened him. He tried to have him kicked out of the clubhouse. And this irked one of the Mets pitchers so much who saw what was going on that instead of coming over to defuse the situation, he came over and threatened to beat the guy up. This is the dumpster fire that is the New York Mets. Unbelievable. I want to give a shout out to Alvin for pointing out that today marks 10 years to the day of my sound off episode 75, my rant on the media coverage surrounding the death of Michael Jackson. July 7th, 2009, I did that show. It was only 20 minutes long, and it's funny because I hear more about that episode of the sound off than probably any episode that I have ever done in the 600 plus episodes of this show. And that episode had nothing to do with wrestling. It was a 20-minute rant. Today would be the equivalent of a 20-minute YouTube clip ranting on this just circus of media coverage around the death of Michael Jackson. And people still talk about it. They still ask me about it to this day. So yeah, that was 10 years ago today. This is, by the way, episode 607, I should probably mention that, of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 7th, 2019. I am the Sala Monster. Vince in Anchorage, Alaska wrote into me about Audible, because you guys know I offer the Audible trial to everybody every week. And he wrote in, he said that I've been asking for suggestions from people for some great non-wrestling books to suggest that they can cash in using their free trial. You get one book that you can download for free when you use our link. And he sent in some suggestions that I thought could be helpful, could be useful to people who are interested. He said he originally subscribed to Audible using our link, which is audibletrial.com/Solomonster. He used that link, and he ended up keeping his subscription for 3 years. So he didn't just sign up, get the free book, and then ditch the trial, which you can certainly do. He liked it enough that he stuck with it for 3 years. And so his suggestions for non-wrestling books, for those of you who may want to sign up and cash in your free book on this: Charlie Wilson's War, which is, he says, hysterical and surprisingly true; Dr. Sleep, which is the sequel to The Shining; and Scores, the true story of New York's infamous strip club tied to the mob. So yeah, there's a lot of good books you can choose from to download. Again, you get one free book, 30-day trial. Try it out, see if you like it. audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And if you want to become a PayPal VIP, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. Right-hand side of the page, you'll see the PayPal button. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. You guys are awesome, because a lot of you go above and beyond the $10 minimum, and I can't thank you enough for that. It's completely voluntary. You can do it, you cannot do it, but I appreciate the hell out of everybody who does, including the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Stephen Foulmouth Fowler, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Killshot Keith Hart, shout out to his niece, adorable Amelia Struble, who turns 2 years old this coming Wednesday, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Stephen Handyman Hallis Stick, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Luck is for Losers Lance Flint, Max the Axe Velada, who also just celebrated a birthday himself, happy birthday, Lee Hired Gun Hieronics, Kingmaker Christos Kalansis, Interfere and I'll Kill You, Inga Wabu, she sounds like the manager of the Mets, Recon Russell Bulware, and I also want to give a shout out to A Man with a Plan Andrew Golden, and Quick Killings Mikey, who says he listens to over 15 different podcasts weekly. That's a lot of podcasts. And says that this one is his favorite. So thank you for that. And thank you for the love in iTunes. I was sorry to hear about the passing of two wrestling legends this week. Jacques Rougeau Sr., the father of Jacques Rougeau, the Mountie, call him whatever you want. And Ray Rougeau, so their father passed away this week. And Ray Rougeau, I think, still does French commentary for WWE. Because when his wrestling career ended, he was doing announcing for them. But I think he may have left. but he, I believe, has come back and for a number of years now has been doing French commentary. But their father was 89 years old. He had been battling pulmonary fibrosis, and he passed away this past week. And also, Pero Aguayo, legend of Lucha Libre, died at 73 years old this past week. He had been battling health issues and I think dementia and some things like that for a long time. He was a heel for much of his career, credited with inventing a few different moves, but credited with inventing the double foot stomp that it seems like everybody uses these days, but you see Finn Balor use it in his matches as a finish. Andrade uses it in his matches. His son, Pero Aguayo Jr., passed away 4 years ago in a match in Mexico, which was a big story at that time and a tragic one. And that came at a time when his son was one of the hottest stars in that entire country. And so he was a huge drawing card in his day. He was also the first WWF light heavyweight champion when that title was first introduced way back in 1981, even though it really was never defended as a WWF title. I mean, it had the WWF name, but that title was really defended overseas a lot, and it was defended a lot in New Japan, even, you know, back in the day. So, and I think he held it about seven different times, but he was the first one crowned back in 81. But a huge star in wrestling, a huge star in Lucha Libre, two big names passing away this past week. Speaking of New Japan, last night was opening night of the G1 Climax 29 in Dallas, Texas, the first time the G1 was opening outside of Japan. Dallas was quite the hot destination for wrestling this past week. We had Raw was in Dallas last Monday, and then New Japan last night. You know, much has been, there's a lot being made, and I talk about it here on this podcast when it comes to WWE, when it comes to, I'm going to talk about Ring of Honor a little bit later, about attendance and attendance figures, AEW. You know, they've only had a couple of shows at this point. All Out is coming up at the end of next month, and a lot is made about how this is a brand new upstart promotion, and they did gangbusters, you know, when tickets went on sale for their shows, and they sold out. WWE, on the other hand, has had a lot of issues packing in buildings and having to tarp off sections and things of that nature, so it's only fair to kind of mention what the attendance situation was here at the New Japan show. And the empty sections were very visible on TV. They did not sell out. I don't even think it was close to a sellout. And you could definitely see empty boxes and empty sections all over the building. But I will say this. Like the crowd, and I gave WWE credit for this when I did my review. Like the crowd that WWE had for the Stomping Grounds pay-per-view, where they tarped off literally one entire side of the building. They took painstaking measures to try to not even shoot it. To the crowd's credit, and I don't remember actually now what city they were in, but to the crowd's credit, they were so loud, you would think that they were sold out. That was a hot crowd, and you would never know that the building was maybe three quarters full. Same thing here in Dallas. And Dallas is a great wrestling city traditionally. A lot of history in Dallas, going back to the Von Erichs and World Class and even before that. But the people who were there were very loud and very enthusiastic throughout the entire show. And I'm sure very enthusiastic just to, I mean, be part of the first G1 ever, G1 show to be held ever in the U.S. And I have to say this, I love their production. I don't know if anybody else kind of had that thought as they were watching it, just visually. I loved it. I actually think visually it may look better than the AEW shows I've seen so far. And that may be more of an access television thing than anything else, but I thought they you know, deserved a shout-out for that, because I thought just, you know, it looked great and came across great on TV. They made a big announcement during the show, which is that their Fighting Spirit Unleashed tour is coming to the East Coast here in the U.S. This September, they're going to be hitting three cities, Boston, Philadelphia, and New York City. In Massachusetts, they're hitting Lowell. What do the people of Boston think about this? Because they call it Boston, right? But it's at the Lowell Memorial Auditorium in Lowell, Massachusetts. Now, how far outside of Boston is Lowell? What does that make the Boston people feel like? Because I got some angry emails when we were talking about All In last year and how they were coming to the Sears Center in Chicago, but it's not really Chicago, right? It's the different, it's technically like a different city or whatever it is, and it kind of irked people who were bothered by that. And I wonder if people in Boston feel the same way when they say, oh, it's coming to Boston, but it's actually in Lowell. So the first show's in Lowell. That's on Friday, September 27th. We have the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City on Saturday, September 28th. And the 2300 Arena, former ECW Arena, in Philly on Sunday, September 29th. And so tickets, if you are interested in trying to score tickets, they go on sale on July 26th. So let's get into it. I'm only going to be reviewing the A-Block matches from here. This is what I saw. I was out part of the night last night. I was able to go back and watch the A-Block matches. I did not see any of the tag matches earlier. I know that, you know, Juice Robinson was there, Jushin Thunder Liger, I think Naito. There were a bunch of big names in some of these earlier matches, but I'm only sticking to the A-Block matches here in the tournament. 30-minute time limit for all of the matches. 2 points awarded to each winner. No points to the loser. First block match here was Lance Archer taking on Will Ospreay. Great big man, smaller man dynamic here. I thought they worked that great here in this match. And Ospreay is, you know, he's a junior heavyweight, but he is trying to make a statement. That's the story going into this tournament. He wanted to be in the G1. It was kind of a big deal when he announced that he was going to be in the G1. And he is looking to represent that caliber of wrestler who, they're not heavyweights. They're not super heavyweights. You know, he's a junior heavyweight. But he wants to show that he can hang with the big boys. Well, Lance Archer is a pretty big boy. And it didn't work out too well for Will Ospreay here in this match. We had an Os Cutter countered. But Ospreay hits the Os Cutter the second time, only for a near fall. Archer hit a muscle buster for a near fall. He put the claw on Ospreay here in Dallas to a big pop. Ospreay made it to the ropes. Ospreay hit top rope Spanish fly to Lance Archer. Very impressive when you consider the size difference between the two of them. In the end, Archer hit the super blackout off the ropes and locked on the claw again to put Ospreay down and pinned him. So Lance Archer picks up 2 points with the victory here. And Lance Archer has spent a lot of time in New Japan tagging with Davey Boy Smith Jr., right? The Killer Elite Squad. Most of the matches of his I've seen were of him teaming with Davey Boy Smith Jr. Well, Davey Boy Smith Jr. just recently quit New Japan. And so now Archer is all alone and he has the chance to really establish himself as a single for the first time in a very long time. And this was probably, look, I haven't seen all of Lance Archer's matches, but I would wager that this had to be one of the best, if not the best match that this guy's probably ever had in his entire career. And a big win. Bad Luck Fale against Evil. Bad Luck Fall is countered by Evil, who hits a lariat. In so doing, the referee gets knocked down. Evil decides to take the opportunity to go ahead and grab a chair. And he buries it in Fale's gut. He wraps the chair around his head. He grabs another chair. He's going to take a baseball bat swing with one chair into the other. Fale stops him, hits a low blow. And then Fale does to Evil what Evil tried to do to him. He wrapped the chair around his head. He grabbed the other one. He swung and he connected. And then he hit the Bad Luck Fall for the win. This was the weakest match of the night. The weakest match of the block by far, so far. But you probably could have figured that going in. I mean, look at the A-Block matches that they had on this show going in. You had to figure this was going to be the weakest of the bunch, and it was. We had Sonata taking on Zack Sabre Jr. It's a Zack Sabre match. So a lot of technical stuff, a lot of counter wrestling. And I guess he felt that the American audience did not appreciate that. Because after the show, he said that putting on a great technical match for a U.S. audience is like reading Shakespeare to a dog. Which is, I think, a great analogy. And not entirely untrue. Although in front of this audience, I have to defend this audience, these people seem like they definitely appreciated it. So maybe that was just him healing it up. Maybe he honestly feels that way about other U.S. audiences because, you know, all I can say about this one is the people seem to be very much into it. Now, you put a match like this in front of a Raw crowd, yes, absolutely. It'll be like reading Shakespeare to a dog or a cat or a lizard or a bedbug. But that's a different audience for a different product, so it's not even really fair to compare. But Sabre countered the TKO attempt into an octopus. He transitioned into an armbar. Sonata fights hard, finally makes it to the ropes. Skull end, countered by Zack Sabre, rolls into a DDT and a dragon sleeper. And Sonata finally hits the TKO a little while later for a near fall. Penalty kick by Zack Sabre, but Sonata counters the Zack driver into Skull End. Moonsault by Sonata is countered into a triangle. Back and forth we go. Another Skull End by Sonata. Sabre's fading. He's fading. Finally, he powers up. He gets the European clutch on for a near fall. But Sonata reverses into a clutch of his own and pins Zack Sabre Jr. And I thought that this was, again, you go into it, especially a Zack Sabre Jr. match, and you kind of know what to expect. And technically, I thought this was great. I thought this was a very, you know, for that style, it was just an enjoyable match. You know, if you went into it expecting that style, I think you got what you were looking for. And I couldn't predict a winner. It was very much back and forth. I'm a fan of Sonata's. I've talked about him before. You know, when I've covered other New Japan shows, I think he, maybe even later this year, if not later this year, maybe next year. I think the last time I talked about him, I said within the next 2 years or so, I think he's going to be a really big deal. And this was a big win for him here. Then we got into the two, I think, really kind of big matches on this show. We had Kenta taking on Kota Ibushi. And this was a very big match here for Kenta. And even on commentary, they said after 5 years, this is how they phrased it. It was something like after 5 years of torment or something like that. You would think that he was locked up in a WWE prison camp. But whenever I talk about Kenta, I have to kind of defend WWE a little bit. I think it's unfair to put all of the blame on, you cannot put all of the blame on them for what happened to Kenta. You know, as Hideo Itami, he was injury prone, unfortunately. You know, during his time, he was snake bitten with injuries in WWE. And the shoulder injury was a very serious one. It didn't heal properly. I think he needed a second surgery. He was out for a very long time. And he just never seemed to be the same person after that. When he came back, he never regained the momentum that he had initially before he got hurt, when everybody was suddenly getting all excited when he started using the GTS, which was always his move. And they teased it for so long. And then finally, he started hitting it and people were going nuts. And I still to this day believe that the original plan was at that Beast in the East show in Japan in the summer of 2015. It was not going to be Finn Balor winning the NXT title from Kevin Owens. I believe that it was going to be Hideo Itami. That show and that spot was earmarked for him. He was on his way. He was building momentum. And then he got hurt a couple months before. And that was it. That was his. It was a huge missed opportunity. And he never ever got back to that same point again. And he was on 205 Live, and he was having some good matches, but once you're on 205 Live, you're pretty much done. You're done. And, you know, unless you're like a newer guy who's first getting his break on 205 Live, a guy like Ali, and that served as sort of an entry for him to SmackDown, or Buddy Murphy, who has yet to even show up on SmackDown, but I'm hopeful that, you know, he will, maybe even as soon as this week. But for a guy like, you know, Hideo Itami at the time, who came in, you know, with some of the fans with a name, and some people knew who he was, and he had a profile, and he had some success in NXT. But once somebody like him hit the 205 Live roster, it was pretty much over. And I think he realized that, and that's why he wanted out. So this is sort of just an opportunity for him to have a career resurgence here. And it's only one match, but I thought he did a hell of a job here. I thought this was an excellent match. We had a lot of dueling chants early for both guys. Ibushi sent Kenta to the floor midway through. He hit a dive out to the floor. Kenta caught him with a knee on the way down. And in landing, Ibushi looked like he may have rolled his ankle, sprained it. He was favoring the ankle, unless he was just doing a great job of selling, which he does. But with him, it's, you know, I feel like it's hard to tell sometimes with Ibushi whether or not he's actually selling or if he's really hurt. All I know is that the ankle never really factored into the match at all after that. I don't think Kenta went for an ankle lock or anything like that. It never played into the story of the match. And Ibushi was clearly, you know, a little hobbled for the remainder of the match. So hopefully he's okay. Because to get hurt on the first night of the G1, you know, with the schedule that these guys are going to have over these next 4 weeks or so, that would not be good for somebody like him. You know, he's one of the big names in the tournament, to suffer an injury on night one. So Kenta draped Ibushi over the barricade after that, hit a double foot stomp to the back of the neck off the apron, or at least whatever neck he has left after that match he had with Naito. He teased going for the GTS once they were back inside. Ibushi slipped out, hit a last ride powerbomb for a near fall. Ibushi went for the Kamigoye knee. Kenta reversed into the GTS position. Ibushi slid out. Kenta hit a jumping knee strike. And with Ibushi down on his knees, Kenta hit four consecutive kicks to the head. And Kenta kicks hard. Kenta kicks very hard. We didn't see a lot of it in WWE, but we definitely saw some more stiff kicks, I think, here in this match from this guy. Four straight kicks to the head. Ibushi kicked out. Kenta then pulled down his knee pad, finally hit the go to sleep, and that was it. He got the pin off the GTS. Kenta helps Ibushi to his feet when the match is over. The two men embrace. I thought this was a great match, and I thought it was a good comeback showing for Kenta. And it helped to have an opponent like Ibushi in there, who sells everything like he's concussed pretty much 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which he may well be, but he's got a lot more matches, does Kenta, in this tournament. I mean, they all do. It's a round robin, but yeah, he's going to have a chance to really show what he's got and show if the old Kenta is back for real. You know, he's going to be facing Tanahashi next weekend. 2 weeks from now, he's going to be facing Okada. So he's got some big matches coming up. Speaking of Okada and Tanahashi, we go to the main event. Tanahashi against Okada. Okada, of course, being the reigning IWGP Heavyweight Champion. Kevin Kelly mentioned on commentary that these two have had three matches previously in the G1, all of which have gone to time limit draws. This, thankfully, did not go to a time limit draw. Okada, by the way, he was raving at Media Day the day before about trying Whataburger for the first time. I've never tried Whataburger. I don't even know. I don't think I've ever heard of them before. I did try In-N-Out Burger once when I was in California for WrestleMania a few years ago, and it was great. You know what's even better? Not having a burger. So they got a standing ovation from the... People are going to be pissed now. Too many barbecues. Too many bad things. I've got to try to get away from that stuff. Anyway, they got a standing ovation from the crowd before they even touched. This felt like a really big deal, just seeing these two live against one another on American soil. I'm still not sure why New Japan did not announce this match would be taking place on this show a lot earlier than they did, even when tickets first went on sale, because I guarantee you, not that they would have sold out the building, but they would have had more people willing to plan a trip and fly out to Dallas just knowing that they could be there to see Okada one-on-one against Tanahashi live in person. To these people, maybe not to, you know, the mainstream wrestling fan who doesn't know much about New Japan, but to this audience, to the people like the ones who were in that building, like the fans who would fly all over the country to go to Double or Nothing or All Out, believe me, more of those people would have been willing to fly out for this show had they announced this far enough in advance. And you wouldn't have had necessarily all of the empty sections that they had. They would have been a little more full. I still don't understand why they just didn't announce it earlier than they did, but it is what it is. So we had a lot of teasing of big moves early on here in the match. Later on, there were dueling dragon screws, probably about five different dragon screws at various points that these guys hit in this match, trying to tear the other's knee out. Okada landed an elbow drop off the top rope, then did his Rainmaker pose, but Tanahashi snatched him into a cradle for a two count, and then hit another dragon screw. There you go. Cloverleaf by Tanahashi. Okada gets the ropes later on with Okada on the outside. Tanahashi heads up top, hits the high fly flow from the top rope out to the floor. Back inside, sling blade by Tanahashi. Okada follows that with a drop kick, and then teases a tombstone. But Tanahashi hits another sling blade instead. Tanahashi off the top rope for the high fly flow. Okada gets the knees up. A little while later, Tanahashi, another sling blade. But Okada gets a backslide, pulls him up, and connects with a Rainmaker. That's Rainmaker number one. And he never let go of Tanahashi's wrist. He always maintained control here. And then hits a second Rainmaker. Now he tries for a third, but Tanahashi cradles him for a near fall. Tanahashi blocks another Rainmaker attempt, slaps him in the face a few times, I guess to wake him up. But Okada hits a spinning tombstone, and finally, a third Rainmaker clothesline for the win. This was a very good match, far from their best, but at least we got a decisive winner and not another time limit draw. Okada wins, he picks up 2 points. Okada cut a promo in English after the match, saying that tonight was the first time the G1 was in America, but it will not be the last, which got a big pop from the crowd. He said next time he comes to Dallas, he will be the G1 Climax winner and the IWGP champion. And I think when I was talking about the G1 a couple of weeks ago, my early prediction was Naito. I figure I'll pick him to win the whole thing. And it is interesting to think about if Tanahashi, or Okada rather, if he wins as the champion, he then gets to pick his opponent for Wrestle Kingdom as opposed to anybody else winning and getting a briefcase and carrying it around with them for the next few months and earning the right to challenge for the title at the Tokyo Dome. And I think on commentary they said that we have not had a situation where a standing IWGP champion has won the G1 since 2000. That's what Kevin Kelly said. That's a long time. Could Okada do it? Sure, he could do it. I think if you're going to look at the top three or four choices of who could reasonably win, he's got to be in the conversation, just like Ibushi and just like Naito. But I don't think he will. I'm going to stick with Naito on this one. Monday Night Raw this past week. They hit Dallas first before New Japan did. We had over 5,700 votes in the Twitter poll. 47% thumbs up, just 8% thumbs down. 45% didn't watch. Even that number is lower than usual. But that is incredible. That is an incredible number for one of these random Raw polls. Almost 6,000 votes. That has to be, I'm guessing, a new record. I mean, I've had numbers like that for pay-per-view polls, but for a Raw poll, that's got to be a new record. And that has to be encouraging. Look at the numbers. 47 up, 8 down. When you factor out the ones who didn't watch, it's an even more impressive percentage. That is an exceedingly positive thumbs-up vote for Raw this past week, when you look at that ratio. I thought that the show had a different vibe in that opening segment, and then it largely just morphed back into the same old Raw for the second and third hours until the AJ Styles Ricochet match and the big turn at the end of the show, which was predictable, but it was the correct outcome. Remember, predictable does not mean bad. I saw some people, oh, it was so predictable. Thumbs down, it was so predictable. Thumbs down, it was so predictable. What the fuck does that even mean? It was predictable, therefore thumbs down. What are you, out of your mind? The hell's wrong with you? That is a dangerous attitude to have, because that means that you want them to swerve you and surprise you. And when the show becomes nothing but swerves and surprises, bro, then nothing makes sense. So I like the ending. I like the beginning and a good part of that first hour, but then everything in the middle, it's like giving us a nice brioche bun with raw meat in the middle that they forgot to cook. It felt like Paul Heyman, I read these reports, Paul Heyman, it felt like his fingerprints were all over the show, his fingerprints, and it did. It felt like Heyman's influence to a degree, or some of his ideas, could be seen and could be felt in different segments of the show, and apparently he was sitting next to Vince McMahon the entire show in the gorilla position. But he has not fully taken over the show just yet. This was not the first Paul Heyman show. You could say some of his influence was there, but this was not really the first show that he has kind of fully, to whatever extent he's going to take over, to where he has fully taken over. I think there were some positive signs on this show, just not as positive as I think everybody is making them out to be. I definitely think that if there was never any announcement, if news didn't leak and if WWE didn't put the official announcement out, that they had hired Paul Heyman to be the executive director of Raw and Eric Bischoff to be the executive director of SmackDown, that a lot of people would not have looked at this show as highly as they did. We have not seen the real changes yet that are hopefully coming, and it's not going to happen right away. But I thought, look, if you thought the show was a thumbs up, that's great. But to that degree, as though, oh, we've been saved. Paul Heyman, thank you, Heyman. Thank you, Paul. You better pump the brakes on that a little bit, because when you really take a step back and look at this show, the full 3 hours, really wasn't that different than usual. They open with a Falls Count Anywhere match with Braun Strowman and Bobby Lashley that ended with Strowman spearing Lashley through the LED set and a bunch of pyro explosions went off. They even had Corey Graves drop an uncensored holy shit line on TV and everybody wet themselves. Oh my god. He said holy shit. Attitude is back. Yeah, even back in the Ruthless Aggression era when Taz did the same thing on SmackDown when the ring imploded. With Lesnar and Big Show, they made sure to bleep it out when he said holy shit. Although that may have had more to do with the fact they were on network TV and not cable. But I did laugh at a lot of the tweets that I saw from people practically orgasming over that line. Like it's some sign that the Attitude Era is back. The man said holy shit. I say it on this podcast every week. Usually while I'm reviewing Raw. As in, holy shit, that was a terrible show. It was a cool thing I'd like to see them do more often in this respect. It's less the cursing, and it's just more, it just makes things feel more organic when you let the profanity fly. It took forever to scrape up Strowman and wheel him out of there. Him and Lashley both were carted away in ambulances. They showed us 1,000 replays of what happened, which they had to do to really sell the devastation of it. It was a big angle. Special effects, you know, they're really trying to sell the idea that this was this catastrophic thing and we don't know physically what condition these men are going to be in. Are they going to live? Are they going to die? We don't know. Cole talked about them being taken to a local medical facility, but Renee Young did let a hospital mention slip a little bit later on, so that's 5 demerits for her. I like the static camera shot that they had from the side. So after this angle was shot, and all the officials and the EMTs rush over and everything, and they're shooting it like they normally would. They then threw it to this just static, stable camera shot from the side of the building. And they left it like that for what felt like a good 5 minutes straight. They didn't cut to a million different angles. They didn't switch camera views. There was no commentary. The commentators laid out. And I thought that it was great. It just felt different. It actually did make it feel more real. So I can appreciate little changes like that. They're claiming Strowman may have suffered a ruptured spleen and a separated pelvis. The fuck comes up with these injuries? I'm also hoping it means that we get a new set for Raw. I am tired of all the LED bullshit. I think it was Eric Bischoff, who in some interview he did many, many months ago, maybe last year, he was talking about the WWE product, and he said, you know, one of the issues that he sees with it is that the shows are just too, what was the word he used? I feel like glossy, maybe. The shows are too glossy, they're too flashy, it's like they almost look too good. Meaning, I guess he would be in favor of a more grittier, maybe a little bit darker look. And I do think there's something to be said for that, but I also just think there's something to be said for having, first of all, different. And the sets are different to a degree for Raw and SmackDown. They are not identical. They are not the exact same thing. But I think back to the days of the simpler sets when you think about Raw in the late 90s or even Nitro, right? That original Nitro set, it was very understated, but I liked it. There was just something about that setup. Maybe it had to do with the fact that you didn't have the giant screen and so it allowed for more fan. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I look back on some of those old shows and I say, okay, I understand that today everything's HD. So things have to be done and shot a certain way. And I understand you want the big screen. Because now it's just backstage segments and videos and vignettes and the Firefly Funhouse and this person telling this other person I'm going to make this match. And Baron Corbin, you know, doing community theater with Lacey Evans up on the screen and all this other bullshit. So you got to have a big screen. Okay, fine. But I do think that it would freshen the look of the show up a little bit. In addition to all these other changes they're going to make. It's not the most important thing in the world, but every little change amounts to very big change, if that makes sense. Every little change that you can count, the color of the ring ropes, the color of the barricade, the set, you add all of these little things up, and it adds up to big changes where one day someone's going to flip the channel to USA and go, there's something that looks different about this show. I like it. It's different. So I don't know if this was done in part because they are going to change up the set or if it's just going to be right back to the way it was tomorrow night. I guess in 24 hours, we'll know the answer to that. We had the first time ever meeting between the Viking Raiders and the New Day, who came out all smiles like nothing had just happened, even though two men may have just been killed. Samoa Joe was out shortly thereafter to attack Xavier Woods. That brought out Kofi Kingston from the back for the save, and you can guess what happened next. We came back from commercial break, and voila, we had ourselves a six-man tag, which ended with Samoa Joe choking out Kofi Kingston for the win. That is the first loss for Kofi Kingston since before he won the WWE title at WrestleMania. The last time he lost a match was to Daniel Bryan at the end of the Gauntlet match, one of the gauntlets that Kofi was in, on the March 19th episode of SmackDown. That's how strong they have kept Kofi since winning the title. He had yet to be beaten even in tag team matches until this week. And he's got wins over multiple wins over Daniel Bryan, Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, Shinsuke Nakamura, and Dolph Ziggler. They have done about as good of a job as they can do to try to convince people that Kofi belongs in the spot that he is in. And it's still hard for a lot of people to see him at that sort of elite level because he just wasn't for so long. It'd be like them putting the championship on Dolph Ziggler. Nobody is questioning the talent that Dolph Ziggler has. But he has been at a certain level for so long that if they just suddenly put their top title on Dolph Ziggler, people aren't going to look at Dolph Ziggler like some kind of big attraction. Because it has been burned and beaten into your brains that Dolph Ziggler and Kofi Kingston were basically career mid-carders in this company. Until one day, in the case of Kofi, he got hot and they ran with it. And it made for this great moment at WrestleMania where he wins the championship and his family and his kids are in the ring. And it was great. It was the highlight of WrestleMania this year, in my opinion. And since then, they've had to work extra hard now to convince people that this guy should be taken seriously, that he belongs in this spot. It wasn't a fluky win at WrestleMania. He's held the title now for how many months now? 3 months? 4 months? Whatever it's been? Some people are just never, ever going to buy him in that role. But I think when you really look at what the company has done, I give them credit. They've done just about everything they could as far as trying to convince people that this guy is a player and you should take him seriously and putting over the Trouble in Paradise kick, which nobody kicks out of. I mean, I've always looked at that kick as being brutal ever since he put a dent in Miz's head that one time on Raw many years ago. He caught Miz with a Trouble in Paradise right between the eyes a little too hard. And it sounded really sick, very sickening. And he put a dent and some stitches right in the middle of Miz's head. So ever since then, I look at that move and I think it's a pretty good finish for him to have. But again, some people just aren't ever going to buy Kofi Kingston as WWE champion. It's just the way it is. And I do think that he will probably not be champion for much longer. I feel like by SummerSlam, whether it's Brock, they're going to swerve everybody and have Brock cash in. You know, I feel a little less, not enthusiastic, but I feel a little less likely or sure of that now that Heyman is kind of firmly on the Raw brand. I don't know that they would want to separate them because Heyman is still going to be the advocate for him. Would they have Heyman working Raw but then working as talent on camera on SmackDown? I guess they could, but I don't know that that makes a whole lot of sense. So given the Heyman move, I'm actually less sure now of the idea that Brock will end up on Fox when SmackDown goes there, but it's certainly still a possibility. And the easiest way to get him on Fox is to do just that, to have him swerve everybody and cash in on Kofi instead and win the championship, and then boom, Brock is on SmackDown. So if they want to go down that road, it's easy enough for them to do that. I enjoyed the 24/7 stuff with Drake Maverick and R-Truth. Maverick is the one who came up with the idea of doing those missing flyers, the missing person flyers, early on when they kind of started this whole angle. He came up with it on his own, and they let him do it on TV. And then he got married, and he decided to have them shoot an angle at his wedding. So what it shows is that this guy is a team player. He's all in. And I think that they see him the same way because he's gotten himself more television time than he has at any other point yet in his time with WWE. I think they appreciate that. And good for him. He's very entertaining. Here, he was supposed to be on his honeymoon with his new wife, Renee Michelle. Very beautiful. She was at the show with him. She had no idea. She was blindfolded. She had no idea that he was taking her to Monday Night Raw. And she was not happy about being there. And he assured her, look, this is just a stop on the way. We're going to our honeymoon. They were honeymooning, I guess, at Disney World, based on all the videos that he's been posting all week. He said, this is just a stop on the way. She said, he is obsessed with winning this 24/7 title. Cesaro was going to have a match with No Way Jose. So Maverick and his wife are shown sitting in the front row, watching the show. And they notice that R-Truth is in No Way Jose's conga line. He even put his 24/7 title down on the barricade for a second. And they get this great shot of Maverick just sitting there. And he had vowed earlier on to his wife, he's not going to go after the championship. And he is just, and his wife is looking at him, looking at that title, and she is staring a hole in him. And it is taking every fiber of his being not to go ahead and just swipe that title away. And later on in the back, when his wife stepped away to go freshen up, Drake clobbered Truth with his suitcase and pinned him to win back the 24/7 title. He finally cracked. He won the championship, and when his wife showed back up, he promised her a 24/7 honeymoon. My man, Drake Maverick. If I had dick pills to promote like every other podcast, this is where I would do it. He's been posting videos since then on social media from his actual honeymoon at Disney World, taking the title everywhere with him, and his wife just looks like she wants absolutely nothing to do with him. She wants to murder this man. He took one photo standing in front of the shark from Jaws, and he positioned the title perfectly to block out her face. He looks so happy to be with his title, and his wife's face is just completely blocked out. I am enjoying this. Sue me. I'm enjoying the hell out of this. The NXT Tag Team Champions were on this show, the Street Profits, and what the Observer mentioned was a Paul Heyman move. Heyman wanted them on Raw. He is a fan of theirs. He even appeared in one of the segments with him. He was in a segment, Heyman was, on TV this week as the advocate for Brock Lesnar. It was very brief. It was in the back. He may have been in more than one segment, but in this backstage segment, he was interrupted by the Street Profits. So clearly, you know, he thinks a lot of these guys. Hey, look, maybe we can get Boombox Brock and the Street Profits in the same segment together. Maybe they can start a new faction. They got to show off some of their personality. They did not wrestle. This would be the second set of NXT Tag Team Champions, almost in a row, to be snatched away from Triple H in the last month or so. I hope this does not mean that they're just going to hand over the titles, though, like the Viking War Raider experience did, and just leave NXT. You know, maybe they'll do Raw and NXT for a while. Maybe this is not just a permanent move to Raw for them, but if it is, I hope that they at least have them drop it the proper way and not just hand it over, not just vacate them. I will say this, though. You know, the main roster could definitely use some new tag teams. So as concerned as I always am when I hear NXT call-ups going to Raw, going to SmackDown, and I'm like, uh-oh, some people can survive it. A lot of people do not. And are the Street Profits just going to kind of get lost in the shuffle? You know, you look at Heavy Machinery. And at first, they didn't really do a whole lot of anything with them. Now they are. Heavy Machinery has been, you know, pretty prominently featured on TV. They're going to the next pay-per-view to challenge for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. They're in there wrestling Daniel Bryan and Rowan. And so they're actually being used. And with them, I would say, so far, so good. But that isn't the case with everybody. So of course you're going to worry. But I think the certainly with Montez Ford, the and really both guys. I don't want to shit on Angelo Dawkins. But Montez Ford is the one who, when I look at him and I watch him, he's the one who, if you said to me, of the two, who do you see big things for in the future, especially if and when the team eventually breaks apart, it's Montez Ford. If either one of those guys are going to go on to single success in this company, it's going to be Montez Ford. So they could definitely use some new teams on TV. The Street Profits would be a new team. I'm not against having new tag teams on the show to kind of freshen things up, but I just hope they know what they're doing. Shane McMahon came out to talk with Drew McIntyre, and I put my television on mute. I just don't care. I just don't care. When I see Shane, click. When I saw the lights flickering, I unmuted the TV. I assumed that The Undertaker was there. Either that, or Strowman and Lashley were being electrocuted again in some other part of the building. Undertaker said Roman Reigns never asked for his help the week before, because that's not who he is. He said that he had a little bit of respect for Shane after their Hell in a Cell match at WrestleMania a few years ago. But Shane fell victim to his own greed and ego. Great. Great. They gave us an explanation. That's what I was hoping that they would do. What wasn't so great about this was the dialogue that they gave Undertaker to read. And it's why these Undertaker promos, I think, are just so played out at this point. The man can talk. We know this. He's talked like a normal person before. I don't want him to talk if they insist on giving him lines like this. Where I'm sending you to, you'll be nothing more than another couple of lost souls, suffering the torment and torture of that acrid stench of death. And that will be for all of eternity. Yes, until the next night, when Shane comes out doing his Shane O'Mac dance. Eternity is apparently 24 hours in WWE Universe time. The acrid stench of death. The acrid stench of this dialogue. My God. I wish there was a way. I so badly wish there was a way that we could have fused together The Undertaker Dead Man entrance with the lights and the effects and the music, right? All that stuff. Because it's great. Watching an Undertaker entrance is always fun, especially if you're there live. I wish there was a way that we could have fused that together with the promos of his old Big Evil character. That, to me, would be the perfect blend of The Undertaker. If they wanted to keep using him. No matches. Maybe the occasional chokeslam. Because even the Tombstone, it's a little hard for him to pick up these people these days. Maybe a chokeslam here or there, big boot or something. Just the entrance and the promo. That's it. That would be ideal. What would not be ideal would be to have Undertaker back in the ring wrestling Sting, which is what WWE was teasing on its social media this weekend. They put a photoshopped picture of the two of them in the ring together with the caption, "Imagine." Imagine. So everyone's wondering, well, what is this about? Is this a tease for a match? Is this something for the 2K20 video game? What is this? Well, before I started recording, because they were promoting something for today. Something was dropping today. And I just assumed it must be some new network show or something. It's not a network show, it's a YouTube series called WWE Reimagined. And this was the very first debut episode. It's up on YouTube right now. It's about 8 minutes long. And what they do in this series, I guess, what they did in this video, is they have footage of two wrestlers from their respective era, whatever era they're talking about here. In this case, the question they pose is, what if The Undertaker had jumped ship to WCW in 1997? What if? And so in the description here, it says, WWE superstars and legends ponder an alternate reality in which The Undertaker jumped ship during the Attitude Era to WCW. And they interview a whole bunch of people. They interview Jeff Jarrett and Bruce Pritchard and Sting himself and Aiden English. And Kevin Owens, and Natalya, and all these different people. Zack Ryder. To get their thoughts on how that hypothetical matchup would have gone. What would have happened if The Undertaker went to WCW? And it's funny, too, because part of what they did in the video was they took that footage from the night on Nitro that The Warrior made his debut. And you see Hogan in the ring, and I think Bischoff maybe was in there with him, and they look all freaked out, but they kind of, they cut the part of the screen off so you can't see The Warrior. But they're kind of going back and forth, splicing in images of The Undertaker to make it seem like it was The Undertaker who showed up that night. So they're kind of, in a way, photoshopping their own shit. So anyway, that was the whole purpose of this. It was finally revealed today. It's just this new YouTube series. And look, there's a whole bunch of them they could do that I'm sure are kind of interesting. They could do Rock and Shawn Michaels. There's a match we never saw. Maybe there's some other WWF guy. What if he would have jumped to WCW? Or maybe what if Goldberg would have jump to WWE in 1998, so they can do an endless amount of these. But until today, until we found out what this was for, all people were talking about the last few days is that are we going to finally get an Undertaker and Sting match? Could this be at the next Saudi Arabia show? Are they seriously considering doing this match? After seeing the video, my guess and my sincere hope is absolutely not. But who knows? Maybe part of why they're doing this is to sort of test the waters and see what the reaction would be. There's always a chance. Imagine, they say. Yeah, imagine. Imagine if they had booked that match 8 years ago when they were running those Cabin in the Woods vignettes, which people thought was signaling the arrival of Sting. His contract with TNA was either up or about to be up. He kept signing these one-year deals. Dixie kept renewing him for a year every single year. And at the time, his contract supposedly was up. And people thought, could these videos be teasing a Sting debut? Could we be in for a Sting-Undertaker match at WrestleMania 27? And as it turned out, it was not for Sting. It was for The Undertaker, who already had a program locked in with Triple H. Triple H had his program locked in with The Undertaker, and it was Triple H's WrestleMania program. So there was no changing it. But at the time, supposedly, there was at least one phone call. There may have been discussions because they saw the reaction from the fans and they had reached out to Sting and it just didn't work out. They could have done that 8 years ago. That would have been the time for it. 4 years ago, WrestleMania 31, the first time Undertaker and Sting were in the same company together with those characters. They actually wrestled in WCW when Undertaker was back in his Mean Mark days, but we're not counting that. But they had a chance then, and they didn't take it. Now, there's differing reports as to why. I have to be fair about this, because it's entirely possible that WWE thought about doing the match. Maybe they even wanted to. But there were reports at the time that The Undertaker straight up did not want that match. He did not want to work with Sting that year. And it's not that he has anything personal against the guy. I don't even know how well he knows him. But he may have been asked, and supposedly The Undertaker may have rejected the idea. I can only assume because he was afraid of what a match like with Sting might look like. Sting at that time was, I don't know, how old would he have been at the time? You know, 54, 55? I mean, Undertaker is, he's younger than Sting, but let's be honest. I mean, he's not that much younger. And in terms of the abuse that he has put on his body, I would argue that Sting may be, he may well physically be in better shape than The Undertaker. But that's the only conclusion I can come to. If The Undertaker just was, for whatever reason, dead set against working a match with Sting at WrestleMania, you know, it could only have been because he was worried about the match sucking and not being any good. Which is comical if that's true. Looking back now at some of the matches that The Undertaker has had since then, that he would be so concerned about the quality of his WrestleMania match. But that's just one report that I heard. That's never been confirmed. The only person who could confirm that is The Undertaker. But apparently, whether it was him or the company's decision, it was so much more important for him to wrestle Bray Wyatt that year. And never appear once, by the way, on television to actually promote the match. He promoted it in video form. It was so much more important for Sting to wrestle Triple H that year. A match absolutely no one, that I know anyway, was clamoring to see. I don't want to speak for everybody, but I doubt very, very seriously that there were an abundance of people out there who, when they thought about dream match scenarios for Sting, if he ever came to WWE one day, or if now he's finally going to come to WWE and he can only do one or two big dream matches, boy, I sure hope it's against Triple H. Yeah, you know who said that? Nobody. Triple H said that. That's about it. Then Seth buckle-bombed Sting later that year, and that was the end of that. And on that, I mean, to this day, I still don't understand why Sting agreed to take two of those buckle bombs in that match with Seth Rollins. You know, in most Seth Rollins matches, especially when he was a heel, if he uses the buckle bomb, he uses it once. He uses it once, and sometimes the guy kind of falls out of the corner, he hits the stomp, but no, he hits the move one time. For whatever reason, in that match, he used two buckle bombs. I mean, you are tempting fate when you do that. And it was the second one, really, that effectively ended Sting's career. And it's nobody's fault. Seth didn't botch the move. He hit the move like he hits it with everybody else. And if WWE thought that, hey, we want to put Sting in a championship match, well, then he's got to be able to hang with the champion. Right? Are you going to dumb the match down because the guy is 55 years old? He could either hang with the champion or you don't put him in the match. Seth, really, if you think about it, didn't do anything wrong. And he did take a lot of shit from people, you know, probably unfairly. Maybe he could have called an audible and said, boy, this is dumb. We probably shouldn't do this. And he did. But it really, you know, when you think about whose fault is it, I mean, you know, if anything, it's WWE's fault for putting him in the match in the first place. But why do it twice? When rarely, if ever, did he do it twice in his other matches? That I will never understand. To a 56-year-old man, no less. So, everyone thinking maybe this is a tease for the next Saudi Arabia show. Could it be? Yeah, it could be. It could very well be. Nobody predicted we would get Undertaker and Goldberg last month. But here's a man who's 60 years old now. Rumored to have spinal stenosis. Spinal stenosis is what ended Edge's career. That's what made WWE go to him and say, guess what? You're done. We're not going to clear you. Sting was told that he would have to have neck surgery. He elected not to have that surgery. That was 4 years ago. Unless he's secretly gone under the knife since then and didn't tell anybody, he is unlikely to ever be medically cleared by WWE. Not impossible, but highly, highly unlikely. That doesn't mean that the Saudi prince wouldn't ask for it. And if they let him wrestle just because Bonesaw McGraw wants him to, then you know what? This company is a joke. This is a match 20 years too late. Now they're putting up videos fantasizing what it would have been like in 1997. Truth be told, that was when the match should have happened. It just didn't work out because they weren't in the same company. It just didn't work out. People said the same thing about Undertaker and Goldberg a few weeks ago. 20 years too late. Look how that turned out. 20 years too late. 8 years too late. 4 years too late. They had their chance, and they blew it. They had their chance, and they didn't do it. The Goldberg fiasco should serve as a lesson. This is not a match that should be happening in 2019, or 2020, or any other year in the future. WWE tells us to imagine. That's where it belongs. In our imaginations. Because today, we can all book a better match in our heads, in our minds, than what we would actually get in reality. Now, tomorrow night, it's Shane McMahon and Drew McIntyre, oh joy, against Roman Reigns and a partner of Shane's choosing, I'm guessing Elias or some such thing. Maybe it'll be the Underfaker from SummerSlam 94. They'll dress up Elias as the fake Undertaker. I cannot stand the Baron Corbin Lacey Evans stuff. I really don't have anything more to say about it other than if somebody ever created an actual physical charisma vacuum, they would be the perfect team to shoot the infomercial for it. We had our obligatory weekly 2 out of 3 falls match, this time between The Miz and Elias. This no wrestling during commercial breaks rule is just hot garbage. You know, it's not as though they didn't used to take breaks during that. I was talking about this with Wade Keller when I was on his show on Tuesday night. We were talking about SmackDown. And we talked about the whole no wrestling during commercial breaks thing. And I made the point about how it's not some kind of new phenomenon. You go back and watch some of those early Raw shows in the like early to mid-90s period, 94, like around that time. They took commercial breaks during some of the matches, but they did it in a way where there was almost this sense of urgency. Like, you know, stay with us for more action, don't go away! Like, they wanted to keep you engaged and let you know that if you changed the channel and left and went somewhere else, you were going to miss something important. Of course, the commercial breaks also felt like they were half the time that the ones today are. I don't know if that's true or if it just feels that way. But, you know, there was kind of a sense of urgency to it. And if you missed a big move, as soon as we came back, they would replay it for us. Now, it's the same formula where you wait for a suicide dive every match. Almost like clockwork. 9 out of 10 matches. You're waiting for that suicide dive. And then you're waiting for Michael Cole to tell us that Raw rolls on. You fools. It doesn't need to be that way every single week for every single match. You can take a break in a way that keeps the viewer engaged, especially if it's a match that people want to see. I actually want to see this match. I want to see the finish of this match. I want to see who wins. So this new edict will hopefully go the way of the Russo soon and end up in extinction. I especially like the one person I saw who was very upset that Elias lost. I wish I would have written this person's Twitter handle down. He was very upset that Elias lost. What have they done to Elias, this person said. They're burying him, or some such thing they said. Elias, look, Elias is entertaining enough. He is mid-card at best. Why does everybody need to be a world champion? He is not. He wasn't in NXT, and he isn't on the main roster. You know where he is right now? He's right where he should be. Please stop. Just stop. Then we had the interaction backstage between the man and the man's man, Becky Lynch and Seth Rollins. Holy shit, was this cringe. I hope they have great sexual chemistry, because their on-air chemistry is non-existent, and now I see that they're joking about it on Twitter. I hear that we don't have good chemistry, Rollins, and then they're tweeting GIFs and memes back and forth, and that's cute and all, but it doesn't change the fact that this sucked. This banter back and forth was, oh, God, I got freaking goosebumps, and not in a good way, watching this segment. They joked that Seth was too impulsive, which was pretty obvious after the events of last week, I would say. Yeah, he's a little impulsive, this guy. And on that note, I have to say this. I have to give the man credit here. Rollins took to Twitter earlier in the week to apologize for his tweet to Will Ospreay last week where he bragged about his bank account. This is what he said. He said, after a few days to sit on it, I'd like to apologize to Will Ospreay for the tweet that I sent his way about comparing bank accounts. It was dumb of me and not in line with my values. The moment I pressed the send button, I knew it was trash, but I was too stubborn for my own good. I stand firm in my sentiments that WWE is the best pro wrestling on the planet, and that I am the best of the best doing it right now. After a hell of a week of travel, our crew did not waver for a second. Top-level humans busting their asses for the love of the game. I could not be more proud to be a champion with this company and represent WWE and the entire industry in the way that it deserves. No more garbage tweets. I can and will be better. A classy gesture on the part of Seth Rollins. I still think a lot of the comments he made in that Sports Illustrated interview were dumb, especially talking about Moxley, but good on him for admitting that the tweet was stupid, because it was. But the banter here with him and Becky was just so bad, and I think it's going to end up backfiring on them if they're not careful, especially Becky. And if they keep playing it up in such a hokey way, and that it's kind of in line with her sense of humor. You know, before she got really hot on TV, she was known for all of her puns, right? So she's always had this kind of cheesy humor, and I think people like her for it and everything. But the whole back and forth thing with her and Seth, as just cheesy as it is, it could end up backfiring on them if it's too hokey. So I think they have to be careful. Maria Kanellis showed up thinking that it was a 205 live taping, I guess, and then realizing that it was Monday. She said that she deserved her own title for pushing out an 8-pound human out of her body. Wow, that's quite the visual. She pushed an 8-pound human out of her uterus. That sounds like it might hurt. Although I've heard kidney stones can be worse, which is something that I hope to never have to go through. Mike Kanellis was there with her, and Maria said, tonight, how about me and my bitch take on you and yours? Yes, she just called the Universal Champion a bitch. And he stood there with a stupid smirk on his face, and Becky said yes. She accepted on their behalf. So there you go. Seth beat up Mike for a while until he forced him to tag Maria in. And Maria immediately jumped down, grabbed the microphone, and announced before Becky could strike her that she was pregnant. And Becky backed off. Mike had this stunned look on his face. Maria was too, because she said that you're not man enough to impregnate me. And Becky put Mike in a terrible-looking disarmer for the quick tap. I can't even call it a disarmer. She took his arm and just grabbed it, and he tapped out. That's basically what she did here. The only real man was Becky Lynch, and she said that maybe next time I'll ask Becky to get me pregnant. That's what Maria said. That would certainly be one way to get ratings up. I'll bet they pick up a good number of new network subscriptions, too, if they want to make people pay for it. Now, Maria really is pregnant. I thought it was all just an angle, but apparently Maria really is pregnant. This is baby number two for the both of them, and supposedly they did not know that she was pregnant when they signed their new five-year contracts a few weeks ago. They found out about it right after, and then they immediately told WWE. So WWE had no idea that she was pregnant until after they signed their new contracts. Now, maybe it wouldn't have made a difference, because right now they do not want anybody leaving. So even if they would have known, I don't know that they would have pulled the deal or anything like that, but they had no idea when they signed those contracts that she was going to be going away for the next 9 or 10 months or whatever it is because she's pregnant again. But we did suddenly get this angle, making Mike Kanellis look like the biggest loser in the world. His wife calling him her bitch, him getting mauled by Seth Rollins with little if any offense, and then being tapped out by Becky Lynch. His wife basically saying to him, you're not a real man. They completely emasculated this dude. But hey, I'm sure that that had nothing to do with them being upset about the pregnancy. After they signed those fat new contracts. I'm sure that's just a total coincidence. This company would never be that petty. Come on. One match I am looking forward to tomorrow night that has been announced already is Becky and Seth in a mixed tag against Andrade and Zelina Vega. I think that should be fun. So earlier in the night, we had Anderson and Gallows egging on AJ Styles, telling him that Ricochet was talking smack about him after AJ beat him the previous week. Ricochet said, you know, he's saying, Ricochet is saying that he's going to beat you the next time you guys have a match. And AJ said, really? I'm going to go track down Ricochet right now. And he ends up slapping Ricochet hard across the face. And Ricochet returns fire in kind. And the match is made for later in the show. It's going to be for the United States Championship. Ricochet against AJ Styles. So AJ pins Ricochet. This was maybe a couple of minutes, if that, into their match. Pins him after a phenomenal forearm. But Ricochet's foot was very clearly under the bottom rope, even though the ref didn't call it. Ref didn't see it. He didn't call it. This was all clearly because of the no wrestling during commercial breaks rule. So they had a second referee let the first referee know that the foot was under the rope and they had to restart the match. So AJ, in fact, was not the new United States champion. Back from break, they restart the match. And they had another good match that ended with Ricochet rolling up AJ Styles to retain the title. Styles was upset, but he got up and he shook Ricochet's hand like a good sport and he called Anderson and Gallows into the ring to join him in a 3-on-1 beatdown. He decked Ricochet. He called them inside. They all beat this guy down. They laid out Ricochet with a magic killer. They had Styles give him a Styles Clash off the second rope. I guess a Super Styles Clash. Heel AJ Styles is back. The club is reunited. And it feels so good. It was nice to see the band back together. Predictable though it may have been, it has been building for weeks. This is the story that they have been telling ever since Anderson and Gallows and AJ, who's been out for a while with an injury, ever since all three of them suddenly showed back up on TV again. AJ has been just, you know, going hard at them, saying, what happened to you guys? You guys are barely even on television, and when you are, you lose. You call yourselves the best tag team in the world. You're not. The Usos are the best tag team in the world. So this story has been playing out now for a number of weeks. You could see it coming, but guess what? You could see the Macho Man turning on Hulk Hogan coming too, back way back in the day. And that didn't make that storyline any less enjoyable. In fact, it's still probably the greatest one that the company's ever come up with. I guess you could say Austin McMahon. That's more of like a long, long, long-term angle there. But the whole Savage, the whole Mega Powers and, you know, Jealous of Elizabeth and then the big split, if that isn't number one, it's in the top three. Greatest storylines that they have ever done. So I loved it. I love that, and I love this one. Anderson and Gallows, according to all the reports that I'm now seeing, have absolutely signed new five-year contracts with WWE. They rejected the first deal that was presented to them. In fact, I think the company took them off the road, so they weren't working house shows and making money off those. And they were kind of at a stalemate because their contracts were coming up for expiration supposedly in September. And there was a lot of belief that they're just going to wait them out, not unlike what Moxley did, and then they're going to leave. And they're probably going to go work with some of their buddies in All Elite Wrestling, or maybe they'll even do some work again in Japan, although I don't think Carl Anderson wants to move back there. But that was the belief. And now they have re-signed with WWE deals that may be even far bigger than the $500,000 per year deals that each of them were said to have first turned down. I saw Sean Ross Sapp over at Fightful.com tweeted out that there's a lot of chatter that these deals are for, in his words, big, big money. Meltzer said, far beyond the $500,000 apiece that each of them were offered the first time. So you can just use your imagination. Are they million-dollar deals? Are they $750,000 deals? Are they $600,000 deals? Maybe they're $501,000. I don't know. That's a lot of money. $500,000 is a lot of money. Per year, assuming that it's per year per person, and not collectively $500,000, that's a lot of money. And it seems that AEW is making a lot of money for a lot of different WWE talents. I hope they can make themselves as much money as they're making for everybody else right now. You know, and I know that this company is getting a lot of TV money coming their way soon, and they're getting a lot of sweet Saudi money. But without there being another place for these guys to go, and this is to the, all the people out there who doubt me and doubt everybody else who mentions the initials AEW when it comes to stories like this and doubts that this is happening because of AEW, that there is a legitimate AEW effect going on here. For all of those people who don't buy that and think it's bullshit and, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, think about it like this. Think about the TV money that they're going to be getting soon and the Saudi Arabia money I'm sure that they're making. They're making bank. This company is making bank more so now than ever before. And I wish I still had the stats in front of me, the percentage of the money that actually goes to pay talent. It's actually very low. So all of a sudden you think that because they have all of this excess money now coming in, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that they're just going to suddenly up everybody's pay out of the goodness of their heart? Is that what you think? Vince McMahon is suddenly, he's decided to spread some of the wealth around on his own because he's such a great guy? He's such a great boss? Is that what you think? I mean, do you think that without AEW, without another company that's going to have television like they're going to have in a few months sprouting up, that people like Carl Anderson and Big Festus, Luke Gallows, and Mike Kanellis and Maria Kanellis are getting the kind of money that they're getting? You don't think AEW plays into each and every one of these? You are delusional if you don't think that's the case. Vince McMahon is not deciding to suddenly pay people more because he's such a nice guy. That's not how this works. There has to be a reason for them to offer more people more money. What do you think that reason is? Gee, I wonder. I wonder what that reason is. I wonder why they're so hell-bent on making sure that people don't leave the company. I guess WWE really doesn't want these guys going to work for MLW or Impact Wrestling. Give me a break. And MLW actually is a great product, but it's not any kind of threat to WWE. But all these stories about they're making sure they have everybody under lock and key, they don't want anybody leaving. Why do you think that is? Come on. There are people that don't believe that. Use your brain. Use your brain. I don't know if AEW is going to become a big success. Who cares? That's not what we're talking about here. Just their mere existence and the fact that they've snatched up big names like a Moxley and a Jericho. And they were negotiating with Omega and the Bucks and they decided to go start their own promotion instead. And all the other people they've signed up. They don't want people going to work for AEW. They don't want to give AEW. They don't want to gift anybody to them. They don't want to gift wrap. Oh, here, take this guy. This guy's been on my television for 3 years now. Here, you take them. They don't want that. So they're going to do everything in their power to pay these people all this money and make sure that they can keep them for 5 years or however many years they signed them for, and they can't go anywhere else. They're mine. Mine. They don't like sharing. Their toys belong to them. They don't want to share their toys with anybody else. And you know what? I say this. For Anderson and Gallows, good for them. Good for them. Anderson has what, like 4 kids? 5 kids? Something like that. That gets expensive. I look at it like this. WWE is finally doing something with them. They've been reunited with their good brother, AJ Styles. If WWE is only doing this to make them happy just long enough to get them to sign a new contract, and then all of a sudden they put them on the back burner for in a few months again, then I guess they'll be the highest paid enhancement talents in the entire world. But when you start getting into just stupid money like this, and you've got a, especially when you've got a family, you do what you got to do. And I know, I get that some wrestlers and some people, they're all about, you know, freedom and creativity. Wrestling is an art form. It's my canvas. I'm the painter. I need to be able to paint my canvas the way that I want to. And then sometimes you get a big fat contract waved in your face and you'd be a fool not to take it. Everybody's different. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Revival come, you know, next year. If the company does the exact same thing with them. Like 3 months before, all of a sudden they make Bret the Hitman Hart, the new manager for Dash and Dawson. I think Scott Dawson's head would explode if they did that. I think he would probably sign a 20-year contract where he pays the company. And then after they sign, Bret Hart suddenly vanishes from TV. Suckers. But as for this show, Rome wasn't built in a day. We haven't really gotten the chance yet, I don't think, to see what a real Heyman episode of Raw is going to look like. We kind of got a little taste of it on this show. But we did have the hot opening angle. We had a good main event with a well-executed heel turn at the end. They started well. They ended well. It's all the stuff in the middle that needs a lot of work. And we still have yet to see the return of Bray Wyatt, which brand he may end up on. I mean, I guess with the wild card rule, he can be on any brand he damn well pleases to be on. It doesn't even matter anymore. And Rey Mysterio is expected back on TV tomorrow night as well. SmackDown Live was in San Antonio, Texas this past week. We had close to 3,300 votes in our Twitter poll. 23% thumbs up, 16% thumbs down, 61% did not watch. More up than down, but that didn't watch number is still way too high. This show felt no different than any other episode of SmackDown. Whereas Raw, at least, had a few things that felt like the brainchild of Paul Heyman. Eric Bischoff wasn't even at the show on Tuesday. He is supposed to be moving his family to Stamford this week, and then he starts his new role officially with the July 16th episode of SmackDown, which is not this Tuesday, but the following Tuesday. So do not expect to see any kind of Bischoff influence on the show, at least until then. There was also no Roman Reigns yet again on his home brand. It's like a married couple. You know, he's married to SmackDown. SmackDown is his wife, but he's never home. And Raw is the other woman. He spends all of his time with her. Kevin Owens opened the show with Shane McMahon and Drew McIntyre. So more talking. I just talked about this in the Raw review. When they came out, I muted the TV on Monday. This at least had Kevin Owens. So I was like, I have to see how this segment goes. And what was interesting about it is Owens was positioned as kind of a babyface here in this segment, to the point where Shane at one point was even talking down to him. But Owens was great. He was reading off of cue cards when he was introducing them. And he mentioned at one point the Undertaker's name, but it kind of ended on one card and was continuing on another. So he's reading this card. He goes, "The Under!" And then he pauses to look at the next card and says, "Taker!" And I just thought, that's why I like watching Kevin Owens. He always finds a way to amuse me in some way. So again, there was tension here between Shane and Owens, and Owens is running footage from Raw of Shane and Drew McIntyre bailing when The Undertaker came out, running scared. And Shane says, "Look, stick to your cue cards." Dolph Ziggler interrupts. The noise you hear is me clicking off the EWR simulator when I read that line. Owens cuts him off and just starts shouting and says, "You're not going to come out here and talk about how it should have been you. It should have been you. Yeah, it should have been you 8 years ago. And it was, kinda, and then it wasn't. And it's not going to happen. Just get over it." And this got a big reaction. There isn't a single mistruth in what he said there with that line. That's the sad part. Dolph's big comeback to all of this was to infer that Kevin Owens is fat and that he should be in a hot dog eating contest. And Owens says, well, at least if I was in a hot dog eating contest, I would win, which is more than you can say about wrestling matches. There was one line where Ziggler was saying he should be WWE champion right now. And he said, all my loyalty. He was talking about all the hard work I put and everything. And he goes, all my loyalty. And I cringed. Because we're watching this. And this is supposed to be real. We're not supposed to be watching this thinking that this is all fake and phony and they're reading from scripts. And so in that context, kayfabe, call it whatever you want. In that context, who gives a shit how loyal you've been? Who cares? What does that have to do with you being the champion? What does being loyal have to do with you becoming WWE champion? Oh, that's right. This is all fake. And I've been here forever. So therefore, how come I haven't been gifted a title reign? I don't know. I didn't see anybody else, you know, on my timeline or anything mention this or be offended by it. I'm not offended. It just, I heard that and I cringed because I just thought it was a really stupid thing to have him say. But this was all to build to Shane making them reluctant tag team partners against Heavy Machinery, with the winners being inserted into the tag team title match at Extreme Rules with the New Day and Daniel Bryan and Rowan. We had Daniel Bryan one-on-one against Big E. They had a good match. Bryan came out the winner in that one. Nikki Cross, speaking of cringe, oof, hosted her own moment of, moment of Nikki, you would call it, with Bayley. This was not good. This was not good. The crowd didn't seem to give a shit about it either. They were making a peep. But all of this was just to build to a match on the spot between Bayley and Nikki Cross, which Bayley won, which is good because she's the champion. We had a face-to-face segment with Kofi Kingston, the WWE champion, and Samoa Joe. Ahead of their title match at Extreme Rules, Kofi said he misses the old Joe. The new Joe loves to hide out and sneak attack people. And he says, your ass is too big to be playing hide and seek. That was a great line. Unlike the Ziggler thinger, that was a great line. Joe promised not to hurt his friends and family if he just reached out and shook Joe's hand. And instead, Kofi thought about it for a while, and instead he flipped him the bird and hit the trouble in paradise. This was the best thing on the entire show. I thought this entire segment did a fine job of kind of building tension between the two of them going into their championship match and what I'm sure will be a loss for Joe, but it is what it is. But I thought this was the best segment on the entire SmackDown show from Tuesday night. We had another Aleister Black segment in the back or in his house or wherever the fuck he is, talking about the knock on his door last week when he opened it. Nobody was there. Ring and run. Somebody did a ring and run on Aleister Black. He applauded the knocker. He challenged that person to show up and face him at Extreme Rules. Now, Randy Orton, I noticed, has not been around. He's not been on television. I think he's been away with his wife or something, but he has not been seen. So I would think that he could be a possibility. Buddy Murphy has yet to debut on TV. So those are two options right there. And then there's Bray Wyatt. The whole let me in thing, right? That was his whole shtick with the Firefly Funhouse segments. I'll light the way, my Fireflies. All you need to do is let me in. And now we're talking about Aleister Black. There's a knock on his door. I'm just saying, you can kind of weave this in a way where it makes sense that it would be Bray Wyatt. I don't like this idea because someone has to lose. And I'm not ready to see either man lose in their first match. I mean, for all intents and purposes, this is going to be Aleister Black's first match. They want you to just forget everything that happened with him and Ricochet in the lead-up to WrestleMania. It never happened. He's a different person now. And as far as Bray Wyatt, they probably would love it for you to just forget about everything that he's done up until this point. And we're probably better off forgetting everything he's done. So it's basically two guys making their debut whenever they're ready to make their debut. And if they make it against each other, somebody's got to lose. And call me old-fashioned, but I think wins and losses should mean something. And I don't want to see Bray Wyatt come back, all the buzz he has. And what? He's going to get black-masked in the face and pinned? Is Aleister Black, after all these weeks of bitching and complaining in these segments like a whiny little girl, going to make his debut and get beaten by Sister Abigail and pin 1-2-3? I don't want to see either one of those things happen. So because of that, I hope it's not Bray. But we're going to find out this Tuesday on SmackDown. They're promoting that we will find out the name of his opponent at Extreme Rules. Then came a weird segment in the back with Shelton Benjamin, where he is asked about the Kofi Samoa Joe title match at Extreme Rules and who he thinks is going to win. And instead of answering the question, he never says a word. His eyes just start darting around the room like he's on drugs. And then he smiles and he walks away without even answering the question. Like he forgot where he left his drugs, and then he suddenly remembered and he looked happy and he went off to go get his drugs. I would like some of those drugs. It might help make sense of what we just saw here. We had Owens and Ziggler in the main event against Heavy Machinery with Daniel Bryan and Rowan on commentary, and Xavier Woods and Big E had their own pancake commentary table, so they were out there as well. The match barely gets going. New Day just decides to up and attack the champions at ringside without any real provocation. This giant brawl breaks out. This was, of course, their way of getting through another commercial break without any wrestling, because we can't have wrestling during commercial breaks. And later on, the match restarts or it continues or whatever, and Ziggler accidentally kicks Kevin Owens, super kicks Kevin Owens in the face. This led to Heavy Machinery picking up the win with the compactor. Otis and Tucker, they are added now to the SmackDown Tag Team title match at Extreme Rules. Owens and Ziggler are not. In fact, it has been announced that Owens and Ziggler will have a match against each other Tuesday night on SmackDown. Owens hit Dolph with a stone-cold Canadian stunner when the match was over. And it was funny because Owens is just, he's in the ring. And you can audibly hear one of the referees outside the ring just trying to get his attention saying, "Look at the hard camera. Look at the hard camera." And then, of course, Owens looks in the hard camera and they go off the air. So what I found intriguing about all of this is, unless it's just a one-week fluky thing, they are positioning Kevin Owens as more of a babyface now, which they started to do when he first came back. Remember those videos? "Oh, I'm the everyman. I'm having pizza and I'm bowling with my kids and I'm, you know, picking lint out of my belly button and doing all the things that all you jabrones do. I'm just like all of you." And so they were doing that for a while, and then Kofi got hot, and they decided to put him in the championship match at WrestleMania, not Kevin Owens. And they abandoned the whole babyface push for Kevin Owens, which I think he was looking forward to. And it didn't happen. But now it looks like they might be going back in that direction, and when you think about the potential opponents for him, not counting Dolph Ziggler, you've got Daniel Bryan, who I think at some point soon needs to get back to doing singles matches, because I don't want to see him just tagging with Rowan for the rest of the year. So a Bryan-Owens feud could be interesting. I'm more intrigued at the idea maybe of bringing up some new talent from NXT for him to work with. Or, even better, keep him heel and have him bring Undisputed Era to SmackDown sometime in the next few months. That was an idea that I pitched many, many months ago. I love the idea of, this probably in the fall, this is well before Kevin Owens came back on TV. And I thought a great way to reintroduce him would be to do so with the Undisputed Era. I just feel like him with a group of his buddies, him in a faction. Yeah, I mean, we've seen him and Sami Zayn as buddies, and we've seen him and Chris Jericho as buddies. We've not really seen him as part of a group. I just think, especially with the history they have, which, I mean, they don't have to bother explaining it to the fans necessarily, that these guys know each other from the indies, but just them working together in some way, I think could be a lot of fun. So there are some, you know, possibilities for him going forward. I guess we'll see what they do with Owens once the Ziggler stuff runs its course. But again, up next, he's got a match with Ziggler on Tuesday, and they're also promoting Finn Balor, who was not on this show, and Shinsuke Nakamura, who was not on this show. But they did that little tease 2 weeks ago. Well, they're going to have a match, and it's not being promoted as a title match. So my guess is that we get Balor and Nakamura on Tuesday. Nakamura wins, or there's some kind of disputed finish, and it leads to a championship match at the pay-per-view. That's my guess as to why they're doing this 6 days, or I guess 5 days, before the Extreme Rules show. Now, Extreme Rules is coming to the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia next Sunday. Right now, WWE is offering 2-for-1 ticket deals for the pay-per-view that end today, July 7th. And we'll see if they extend the offer beyond this weekend. I've gotten messages from people saying that WWE is offering similar ticket deals for live events in Utica, New York. They had a show in Utica yesterday. Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, tonight. And I would love to hear from anybody in that city who can tell me, please, once and for all, what is the proper pronunciation of that name? Because I've heard it so many different ways. It is ridiculous. There has to be somebody who lives there who can finally give me the answer I'm looking for. Because I've heard Wilkes-Barre. I've heard Wilkes-Barre. So which is it? Animal or fruit? Which is the correct pronunciation? Or maybe they're both right. I mean, some people who live there may have different answers for the question. You might get a different answer from different people who live there. But if somebody's listening and knows the answer, please let me know. But that's a lot of ticket discounting. They've got to try to fill those seats somehow. So they're going to offer 2-for-1 ticket deals. They're going to try little tricks to get people to come to the shows. And, you know, it's sad, even with The Undertaker now for the last 2 weeks being promoted as a big attraction at this pay-per-view, him and Roman Reigns being a tag team for the very first time, they're still struggling to move tickets to that show. You know, when I checked the site on Friday, I could get floor seats in the second row. One ticket, $570. Now, you can kiss my ass with that. I ain't paying $570 to sit front row at Extreme Rules, or second row, whatever it is, but if you've got the money to burn, hey, there you go. I did hear from one listener after I tweeted about this who thanked me because he was able to score 2 floor seats for under $300. I assume that's under $300 total for 2 floor seats. So, hey, happy to serve. And to show that it isn't just WWE struggling to move tickets these days, Ring of Honor seems to be having a bitch of a time filling seats for its return to the Hammerstein Ballroom in 2 weeks. The way things are going, this could be the very last time we see them inside Hammerstein for the foreseeable future. I know that's not a cheap venue for them to rent, but one sign is the promotion's final battle show. You know, final battle is sort of their big climax each December. Traditionally, final battle is at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York. It will not be this year. It's been at the Hammerstein each of the last 3 years. In fact, you know, with the exception of their show in 2015, which was in Philly, Final Battle has taken place in New York City pretty much every other year, dating back all the way to 2005. That was the year John Cena won his very first world title, just to put some context on how long ago that was. So for Final Battle this year, instead they've booked a venue in Baltimore, which is where the company is now based. That's a sign. That is a sign. And not a good one. Now I'm going to be at the Hammerstein show in 2 weeks. That's their Manhattan Mayhem show. I think it's a TV taping. So I'll be able to see in person what the attendance is like. They have totally, from what I saw in the graphic on the Ticketmaster page, they have totally closed out the balcony, except for this one row that has, it's like 9 seats in this one row in the entire balcony that are listed as verified resale tickets that appear to be available to buy, I guess, if you want it. So if you want to rent out an entire row with your friends, you can go ahead and do that. You could have the whole balcony to yourselves, probably. I'm assuming, though, they're closing the balcony off to force people to buy tickets down below to make it look more full because it is a TV taping. But Ring of Honor seems to have peaked, honestly, with this MSG show that they had back in April. They did not build any goodwill at all for themselves coming out of that Madison Square Garden show. Now, people seem to be happy generally with what they got out of the New Japan matches. And I was at that show as well, and I was not impressed by what I saw from the Ring of Honor end of things that night. You know, and there's a lot of people who are very cold to the idea of Matt Taven being the champion. They didn't put the belt on Marty Scurll or someone else, and so they really did not build a whole lot of goodwill with their audience coming out of that MSG show. And I don't think that they really have fully recovered from it yet. Although they did sell out the ECW arena. They did sell out the 2300 arena for their show in Philadelphia last week. I do want to mention that. I don't know what the capacity of that building is. I don't think it's a terribly big building. But it's going to take more than one show to quiet a lot of the chatter that is out there about the company right now. And unfortunately for them, it ain't good.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
Mia Yim does indeed appear to be next in line to challenge Shayna Baszler for the NXT Women's Championship after her win over Aaliyah in the opener on NXT this week. She finished her off with the protect your neck finish. After the match, she went over to the announce table with a message for the champion, telling her, "I'm coming to whoop that ass." Well, you can try, but I'm just not feeling Mia as the next challenger for the title. At least not at a TakeOver. Maybe they'll do it on NXT television and not TakeOver. Nothing new with Io Shirai and Candice LeRae. They did show us highlights of what happened the week before when Io lost the cage match to Shayna and then turned on Candice and beat her down with the steel chair. William Regal was about to comment on the situation with Kathy Kelly in his office when the Forgotten Sons of Anarchy stormed in. Regal says that they got themselves disqualified in their tag team title match with the Street Profits, and so they moved to the back of the line. And he announced that this Wednesday it's going to be the Street Profits defending their titles against Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. No doubt with a screwy finish incoming, thanks to the Forgotten Sons of Anarchy. Then came the highlight of the show. Adam Cole continues his championship celebration tour. This week, he traveled to a deli and pizza shop called Gargano's out of Cleveland, Ohio, run by Frank Gargano, the father of Johnny Gargano, who Adam Cole, of course, beat to win the NXT title. The Miz's dad, George, owns a bunch of Mr. Hero sandwich shops around Cleveland. So I'm wondering, how long before we get a Miz-Gargano feud on television once he hits the main roster, centered around whose dad runs the better shop? Hey, I mean, maybe we'll get a tag team match out of it. Father and son against father and son. Cole walks into the deli, and he sees, which I thought was a pizza shop. I thought it was a pizza store. It really isn't. It's a deli. You can look it up. It's on Yelp. But Cole walks in, and he sees Frank. And that was, by the way, Johnny's real father. You can see him in the crowd when Gargano won the championship. He goes over, he hugs his dad. That is his father. His mother was in the segment too. So Cole walks in, he sees Frank, and hey, it's good to see you. He's wearing an NXT shirt, is Frank. He's got a wall of fame with pictures of his son on it. And he and his wife recognize Cole right away. They did not look at all thrilled to see him in their store. And he was there to pick up four pizzas that he had had Roderick Strong call in a little bit earlier. Because I'm here to pick up four pizzas. That's for me. So Frank disappears to the back to go get them. His wife follows him to the back. And Cole walks over to the Wall of Fame. And he tacks a photo of himself with the NXT title onto the wall. And he picks up the pizzas once Frank comes back at him. As he's walking out the door, he turns around and he points out the Wall of Fame to Frank. He says, "That's a hell of a wall you've got there." And he leaves, and Frank looks over, and he sees the picture. He goes over, he pulls it down. So we didn't get a beat down of Frank Gargano the way that Edge slapped John Cena's father that one time. Or was it Randy? I'm trying to think now, because I know Edge slapped Cena's father. And I think, was it Cena's father who got punt kicked by Randy Orton? I think it was. Yeah. Well, I mean, Mr. Cena, he works for an independent wrestling company, so it's not like he's, you know, he can sell a beatdown. Yeah, that's fine. But anyway, so we didn't have anything like that here in this segment, but I just thought this was gold. And when it was over, I just thought to myself about Cole. I said, boy, what a douche. So mission accomplished. Cole, by the way, not Frank. Cole then took the pizzas to the wrestling school where Johnny used to be a trainer. And Gargano had even stopped by there recently as the champion. They had highlights of the last time Johnny Gargano was there, and he's showing off the NXT title to, you know, his students and everything, and everyone's all happy. So he goes to the school, and he says, "Look, I come in peace. I come with pizza." He totally buried all of the students, including this one guy who disagreed with Cole that he couldn't one day become the NXT champion. He felt he could one day become NXT champion. And Cole told all of the students, go home, take a pizza, sit on the couch, and just give up. Cole may give Tony Robbins a run for his money with that type of motivational speaking. So whereas Johnny Gargano, when he was there, told all of his students, you gotta follow your dreams, chase your dreams, Adam Cole's message was, get out of this town, get out of this city, and find yourself a new hero. From the Mr. Hero sandwich shop. No, I'm just kidding. He didn't say that. But I thought this was tremendous. This was just, he was a total dick in both parts of the segment. This is where heel Adam Cole can just shine through. And I just thought this was fantastic. Kushida got a win over Jeff Parker with what he is now calling the Sakuraba lock. Used to be the hoverboard lock, but no more. We got a Killian Dane vignette. He is coming. He's coming soon to NXT. May he be shown more respect in NXT than he was on the main roster. NXT Breakout Tournament. Another first round match here. The former Trevor Lee, now Cameron Grimes, against Isaiah Swerve Scott, the former Shane Strickland and Killshot from Lucha Underground. He explained to us in a little pre-match inset vignette that Swerve stands for confidence. That's not true, bro. That's not true. You only think, bro, that it stands for that, bro. But when you find out that it stands for something totally different, that's a swerve, bro. That's a swerve. Anyway, this was a great display for both guys. I really liked this match a lot, although I think it was a better showcase for Scott than it was for Grimes, but maybe that's just me. Crowd seemed pretty stunned, so was I, when Grimes won the match and scored the pin. He picked up the pin with a standing double foot stomp off the ropes as Strickland, rather, was coming off the ropes. I think the wrong guy won here, but, you know, that's just me. I wouldn't have bounced Scott out of this as quickly as they did here, but find this match. If you haven't already seen it, watch it for yourself. We're only two matches into this tournament. I'm already loving it so far, and, you know, as it progresses, given the talent that's in it, it's only going to get more wild. It's kind of like the Cruiserweight Classic. I love the hell out of the Cruiserweight Classic. Really, a lot of the tournaments they've done. The Mae Young Classic, the Cruiserweight Classic, the UK Championship Tournament they did a couple of years back. They've just been knocking them out of the park. And as they go on, and as they progress, they only get better and better. So, as good as the matches have been so far, I can only imagine what the other matches in the later rounds are going to be like. We have Bianca Belair, who recently suffered two pinfall losses for the first time in her career to Mia Yim. She destroyed Priscilla Zuniga, the former Diamante from Impact Wrestling. She just straight up demolished this woman. Shoulder tackles in the corner like she's Brock Lesnar. Press slammed her into the air, did squats with her up there before dropping her flat on her face. Zuniga tried to fight back, went for a Rana coming off the top rope, but Belair caught her, stood firm, muscled her up into a powerbomb position, powerbombed her, held on, picked her up for a second powerbomb, held on, muscled her up again. This was, talk about Brock Lesnar, this is what he did on his debut night on Raw, he did this to poor Spike Dudley. So she picked up Priscilla for what looked to be a third powerbomb, but instead, she gave her the alley-oop. She flung her backwards, face-first into the post and into the turnbuckles. And then she hit the KOD for the very decisive victory. And so now you see, when you lose, this is how you should be. Pissed off and violent. That's what Bianca Belair was here. She didn't come out. She wasn't fooling around. I mean, she kind of had a smirk on her face, but she wasn't happy. And she beat the piss out of this woman. Because that's the way it should be. Main event was Roderick Strong against Tyler Breeze. Breeze took a nasty bump on the edge of the ring steps when Roddy dropped him with a back suplex. Then he dropped him back first on top of the barricade. Strong used a Romero special on him, still working over the back, but Breeze fought out of it. He escaped the stronghold, but Roddy kicked out after eating a supermodel kick. Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish ran down. Breeze hit Fish on the apron with a super kick, but this allowed Roderick Strong to hit the end of Heartache for the win. One of the best-looking finishers in the entire company. Very similar to the other best-looking finisher in the company, which is the lumbar check from Cedric Alexander. But here, yeah, he gives the person a release suplex, an X-plex, And on the way down, he lands on Roddy's knees for the backbreaker. It just looks brutal. This was a fun episode. I would say the highlights easily were the Adam Cole video, which is on WWE's YouTube channel. If you do not have a network subscription or you do not want to navigate through the entire episode just to find it, you could just find it on YouTube. And the breakout tournament match, which you should definitely track down between Cameron Grimes and Isaiah Scott. The weirdest news item of the week is that former UFC heavyweight champion Cain Velasquez will make his pro wrestling debut, teaming with Cody Rhodes and Psycho Clown, to face Tejano Jr., Taurus, and a mystery partner at AAA's big Triple Mania show next month in Mexico City. What a team! Cain Velasquez, Cody Rhodes, and Psycho Clown. And the man who is training Cain Velasquez, Killer Cross. Now that's a tag team. What a tag team those two would make. Cain Velasquez and Killer Cross. Wow. Show will air on Twitch, live in the US on August 3rd for those who want to tune in. Also on that show will be a rematch from Fyter Fest, the AEW show, with Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks taking on Pentagon, Phoenix, and Laredo Kid. You know, I haven't heard anything new about this. AAA is running Madison Square Garden for the very first time on September 15th, and it was almost like you would never even know it's happening. And I'm in New York, so if there was any kind of special advertising for it, we'd have it here, and I have not heard, I have not seen anything about this. They are now said to be looking, AAA is, to All Elite Wrestling for a little bit of a boost. But they may not be so receptive like they were for, you know, for example, some of their talent being on the Triple Mania show in Mexico. They may not be receptive because, unlike Triple Mania, the MSG show is taking place here in the U.S. Now, I look at this and I say, of course, AAA would want a little bit of a boost from AEW. They'd want some AEW talent on that MSG show. It's like Ring of Honor. You think Ring of Honor is selling out Madison Square Garden when they did, if they don't have New Japan Pro Wrestling on the card? Now, they may have done well because it's WrestleMania weekend, everybody's in town, but the real, you know, I think the real reason they packed it in for that show the way they did is because of the New Japan connection. So here, you know, AAA, they ain't going to sell out Madison Square Garden, not even close. And frankly, even if they got some AEW talent on the show, they still are not going to sell out Madison Square Garden. I don't know how many tickets they've moved so far, but I would be shocked if the number is any good. They're going to need all the help they can get, but they may have to look somewhere else for it, and I don't know where that would be. Let's get to some mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We'll start with Deadwood Dylan from Toronto, who recently got engaged, so congrats to him. You recently spoke about Shawn Michaels and his tale of two careers, pre- and post-back injury. You could argue that The Undertaker had an equally impressive quality increase in the second half of his career. Let's say pre-American Badass and post-American Badass, unless you feel that that gimmick belongs in the first half of his career. Who do you think had the better second half, Shawn Michaels or The Undertaker? That is a great point about the second half of Undertaker's kind of career as far as his ring work and the caliber of his opponents compared to some of the big men he worked with early on. My vote still goes to Shawn Michaels. I still say Shawn Michaels had the better kind of second half of his career. He also didn't miss as much time as The Undertaker did due to injury. Undertaker missed a lot of time. And that's why there's so many Undertaker returns. There's videos on YouTube that have nothing but clips of Undertaker returns over the years. He had like 20 different returns. Why? Because he keeps getting hurt. What do you think? He's on a summer vacation? He's vacationing in the Bahamas? No, he's hurt. And so he missed more time than Shawn did. And also, you know, honestly, Shawn Michaels knew when to get out. And Shawn Michaels could have gone on for another year or two or three and probably had a lot of great quality matches and told some great stories. But he knew when to get out. He knew when to call it quits. Now, he did come back for that one match last year, but he stayed out of the ring for 8 years. He had a date and a time and a show, that being WrestleMania. in mind for how he wanted to go out. He knew when he was going to quit, and he quit. Undertaker, once the bell rings now, it's just sad to watch. It's a great entrance, but once the bell rings, that's a whole different story. And some people would say that he's actually harmed his legacy by staying around for too long, or he's harmed the way that they view his career. I think that it's a fair point. I say that Shawn Michaels had the better second half, but Undertaker was a freak of nature in the mid-2000s. He was having better matches than he had when he was 10 years younger. And this was a guy who was told in 1998 that he would need to have a double hip replacement when he was done and probably would not be wrestling very much longer. That was in 1998, over 20 years ago. And, you know, even 10 years after that, he was having some great matches over the course of that decade with Randy Orton, with Edge, with Kurt Angle, with Batista, with Shawn Michaels, with Triple H. Great second half that would have been damn near perfect had he ended it at 20-0 with that end of an era win over Triple H at WrestleMania. You know, the CM Punk match that following year at WrestleMania 29, that was very good, and you could even argue it was maybe the best match on that entire show. But it wasn't so good and so out of this world that it was worth spoiling what I think would have been a fine way for The Undertaker to ride off for one last time at WrestleMania 28. Josh, in Texas, I'm curious your opinion as to why AEW has yet to approach Tennille Dashwood to be part of their women's division. I thought she had a ton of potential and is definitely easy on the eyes. Do you think her injury history is holding her back, or is it something else? That's a good question. I don't know what it is. I don't know why Emma has not been snatched up by AEW or somebody else. I mean, she was in Ring of Honor briefly, and then she wasn't. And I don't recall offhand if that was her decision or if something happened and the company let her go. She's been hurt before, but I mean, I don't think, when I think of Emma, I don't think, oh, she's so injury prone. She's had so many different injuries. I mean, maybe she has. I know she got hurt. Was it her shoulder she got hurt with once, I think? So I don't think it's her injury history, because she doesn't strike me as somebody who's like injury prone. I haven't heard horror stories about her, like she's difficult to work with or deal with. She's got a bad attitude. I've never heard any kind of stories or rumors about her like I have other people. So I'm not really sure why she hasn't been approached yet, unless she just, maybe she was, maybe she turned him down for some reason. But I have not heard her name mentioned at all in any of these AEW stories, talent that AEW might be going after. Her name has not come up once. This question comes from HBK's Lazy Eye from Chandler, Arizona. I was curious, see what he did there? If you could go back and change the winner of any match in wrestling history, what would it be? That's a pretty wide-ranging question. So when I first got it, I mean, I thought of a whole bunch of matches when I first got this question. And look, you could open it up. He said wrestling, so technically you could open it up to other promotions. You could open it up to WCW and include Goldberg beating Kevin Nash or Kevin Nash beating Goldberg, rather, at Starrcade and not ending the undefeated streak for Goldberg when they did. But I'll keep this to WWE, because most of the matches I thought of are WWE-centric. There aren't really any match outcomes I could think of that I would change that jump out at me from what I would call the golden era, you know, when I was younger, the days of Hogan and Warrior and Savage and DiBiase and Mr. Perfect and Rick Rude. I mean, you could look back and say, God, you know, this guy should have won. But nothing that really jumps out is like, this is the most egregious example of somebody going over when they shouldn't have. So from those early kind of part of the 90s, late 80s, early 90s in WWE, I don't really... I mean, look, I guess if you were a big Lex Luger fan, you could say that Luger should have won the championship and won that match decisively and not by countout at SummerSlam. But again, I'm not going to die on that hill because I don't really give a shit about Lex Luger. Lex Luger's old matches. For me, here's some of the matches that I came up with here. And a lot of them really are from the last decade or so. But there is one WrestleMania match from earlier, from 2003. And you guys know which one I'm thinking of. Triple H and Booker T. WrestleMania 19. Just because of the way that that match was built up and the racial overtones and people like you don't win championships or like dance for me or whatever. All the stuff that Triple H said in his promo, which would have paid off wonderfully if Booker T had kind of stuck his fist down his throat and beaten him for the championship at WrestleMania. And there's been a lot of stories told over the years about how that was the original plan. You know, they were going to put the title on Booker T and Triple H had it changed. I don't know if that's true or not. I can't say for sure. But that finish was infuriating. And that would be one match outcome, if I could go back in time, that I would change. It is not the match outcome, but it is one of them. Another one is the match that Triple H had with Sting at WrestleMania 31. Triple H said, and this is what Triple H said actually just recently, he was asked about this. He did an interview, I don't remember where it was, but he did an interview and he said that they had no choice. They were basically up against the wall. They were boxed in that situation because they were going to set up a segment later on that night at WrestleMania, which they did, with Triple H coming back out, him and Stephanie in the ring with The Rock and Ronda Rousey. And the plan was to build to a singles match at WrestleMania in Dallas the following year between The Rock and Triple H. So the idea is that he had to win. Because when he comes back out later in the show, it's weird if he already had a match and he lost, and now who cares if you're going to promote him for another match, which I understand the logic, but I don't think it would have mattered. I think people would have either been excited to see Rock against Triple H or a mixed tag, or they wouldn't have. I don't think him losing to Sting, you know, in Sting's one and only WrestleMania match, I don't think it would have made a difference. But that was how he explained it. He said, we were doing this, and so therefore I had to go over in the match with Sting. That's a match outcome that I would change. I think it sucks that in his one WrestleMania match, it was against Triple H, and he couldn't even win. Like if it was against, there are some other people where if it was Sting against somebody else, it might have made sense for Sting to lose. Had they done Sting and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 31, Undertaker would have won that match. And if I'm booking the match, Undertaker would have won that match. Now, I would have done a double retirement match, so people know going in that this is the final match of both guys' careers. And just let them go out there and just balls out, have the best possible match at that stage that they could possibly have, smoke and mirrors, and in the end, The Undertaker wins. And then they can both kind of shake hands out of respect when it's over and get a big ovation, and ride off into the sunset. That would have been a cool way, I think, to play that out, whatever. I guess Undertaker didn't want to work with Sting, it didn't happen, and so it is what it is. But if I could change things, yes, Sting would beat Triple H in that match. And then we had another Triple H match. I don't want to make it sound like I'm beating up on Triple H here. Believe me, there's more matches I could pick, but I'm centering on these three of his. Is the match he had with CM Punk at Night of Champions in 2011. Punk was red hot at the time. He was the hottest act in wrestling. He had just come off his WWE Championship win over John Cena in Chicago, and that just great match at Money in the Bank. He beat Cena again at SummerSlam, even though later that night he lost the title to Alberto Del Rio when he cashed in Money in the Bank. So with Punk being the hottest thing in wrestling, of course, Triple H had to get involved. Not only Triple H, but Kevin Nash. They got Kevin Nash involved in this angle with CM Punk, hot as he was at the time. Kevin Nash, lucky him, got to powerbomb Punk on television three different times. Punk got that one great line off about, you know, he was texting his sister or something, LOL, Kevin Nash is still alive, I didn't even know. And then Nash, of course, came back with the short order cook at a Waffle House, and yeah, they went back and forth. But Nash, physically, got his hands on Punk and powerbombed him on TV three different times. Punk never got his revenge, because the planned match, and yes, they were going to do a pay-per-view match between CM Punk and Kevin Nash, and God only knows how that match would have turned out. Morbidly, I kind of wish we would have gotten to see it. But the planned match never happened. It got canceled. Nash was on a drug called Plavix, and WWE doctors would not clear him. So it screwed up the entire storyline, and they had to rush the planned match, which I guess eventually would have happened, maybe at Survivor Series, between Punk and Triple H. They had to rush it And they did it earlier. They did it at Night of Champions instead. It would be like cutting the middle chapters out of a book. And so it took a ton of interference. Miz and R-Truth ran in. Kevin Nash ran, well, walked in. So there was a ton of interference. It took three pedigrees to get the job done. But Triple H still beat CM Punk. At the peak of his popularity, this guy was the hottest thing in wrestling. And Triple H, I don't care if it took 10 pedigrees, he pinned CM Punk. And what purpose did that serve? Nothing. I think Triple H just disappeared after that. I don't even think he wrestled another match for a while. But he had to beat CM Punk. He just had to, I guess, right? He had to pin CM Punk. Absolutely maddening. And it wasn't even like a heel face thing. They were both baby faces. Triple H was sort of positioned as the babyface authority figure going into this thing. Punk, maybe in their mind, Punk was the heel. He was acting heelish, but he wasn't, you know, kind of treated like one. The fans treated him like he was the biggest babyface star on the roster. But he just had to get that pin on CM Punk. Absolutely ridiculous. John Cena beating Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania 30. That's another one that I would change if I had the power to do so. That should have never happened. Not in that first match, anyway. But Cena had to win the feud, and so he won the first one. Bray won the second, if you could even call it a win. He won because John Cena got scared by a little child. No wonder he doesn't want any kids. And then Cena won the final match of the three. So I guess to kind of complete the program, they felt Cena had to win the first match. Then there's the end of the streak. On that very same WrestleMania, in fact. Now, they made the most of it with Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar beat The Undertaker, and we got those great fan reactions, the facial expressions. People were shocked. The most shocking match outcome in the history of WWE, of WrestleMania. And it's up there. I mean, is it the most shocking match outcome ever in the history of wrestling? I don't know all of the matches in the history of wrestling to be able to say that. I'm sure when Bruno lost the championship to, Ivan Koloff? You've heard stories about that too. You could hear a pin drop. People were so shocked. But it's way up there. It was a moment. And they made the most of it with Brock Lesnar. They just turned him into a complete monster, into a beast. But the streak never should have been broken. And there's a lot of people that agree with me. There's a lot of people that disagree with me. And they think that's stupid. If The Undertaker was going to call it quits, at some point he would have had to have lost and do the honors and put over the next person. And I say, in this situation, no. He didn't have to do that. There are just some situations where you can let sleeping dogs lie. He could have retired with the streak intact. It would have been part of the legacy of his character, and they could have pointed to it at the Hall of Fame. And it's one of those things where he never should have lost. So I would not have broken the streak, even though it did end up benefiting Brock Lesnar a lot. I would have gotten the best of both worlds. I would have had Undertaker win, and then later on I would have had Brock just snap because he lost, and go on a monster ripper streak anyway. And you could have gotten to the exact same destination, with Brock Lesnar killing people and becoming the heavyweight champion. So no, the streak did not have to die. And I said this earlier when I was talking about The Undertaker. It should have been over at WrestleMania 28. End of an era, 20-0. Undertaker rides off undefeated after that great final shot on stage with him, Shawn Michaels, and Triple H. That should have been it. But the match outcome out of all of them, that's a whole bunch I just listed, but the one match outcome out of all of them that I would have changed if I had the power to do so and only change one, it would have been the Nexus beating Team Cena at SummerSlam 2010. And you know, you could look at The Undertaker and Brock Lesnar and at least point to them creating a monster out of Lesnar. There was some benefit that came out of that. You could look at Triple H beating CM Punk and say that, well, it didn't really affect Punk's popularity. It's not like he died after that. He fell back to the mid-card. I mean, the guy went on to win the world title and held it for over a year. So you can point to some of these match outcomes and how it may have hurt, or maybe it was the wrong outcome, but it didn't really adversely affect the other person too much. But absolutely nothing good came from John Cena almost single-handedly dismantling the Nexus in that match at SummerSlam, taking a DDT on the concrete floor and kicking out of it. I mean, when they shot that Nexus invasion angle, there were people comparing it to the days of the NWO. People were so excited. They had never seen this before on WWE television, or it had been so long since they had seen something even remotely close to this. So, of course, the comparisons immediately started with the NWO. Now, I don't think I would go that far, but it did remind you of that. It was honestly the closest thing to it in many years. It felt real. Cena was wrestling CM Punk. This is when Punk was under a mask. And they did fan voting that night, and they voted Punk in as Cena's opponent. That was the main event of the show, when all of a sudden these Nexus guys showed up out of the crowd, and they ganged up on Cena, but Punk was a heel. And I love what they did, because even Punk went after those guys. And they beat him down, too. It was like, for a moment there, babyface and heel, it didn't matter. You know, these guys, it was like a real invasion, and Punk was trying to fight back, but he couldn't do it. He got beaten down as well. You know, the pulling up of the mat, exposing the plywood underneath, attacking the announcers at ringside, Ryback overturning the announce desk, just pure carnage, and each member had a chance to shine in that segment. Except maybe Michael Tarver, who walked right into the path of Daniel Bryan in the middle of a kick on John Cena. I'll just chalk that up to him being a little too excited and inexperienced. But they really had something special with those guys. And with Wade Barrett as the leader, he was the mouthpiece. Yes, they were green and very inexperienced, but Barrett, even then, was a fantastic talker. He was a fantastic public speaker. He was a great person to have in that role. Now, they almost killed Ricky Steamboat for real in one of their beatdown angles, but they had something special, and they killed it for no good reason. They were never the same after that. Even Cena himself, later on, admitted to Edge and Chris Jericho that he had made a terrible mistake. Jericho and Edge were dead set against that finish. They found out what Cena wanted to do with the, you know, with the whole sequence there at the very end, that I'm going to pin them both. And they were like, dude, that's a stupid idea. They said Cena wanted to do things a certain way, and it sucked. And then after Cena went up to them, it might have been that night when he got to the back, he went up to Jericho and Edge, who had already been eliminated in the match earlier on, and he said, I was wrong. You were right. Jericho said that Cena, he wanted to get DDT'd on the floor and then kick out and beat them both. It was Wade Barrett and Justin Gabriel were the last two in there with him. And that's exactly what he did. And they thought, you know, Jericho and Edge did, that that was just the dumbest thing. These guys are the hot act. They felt they should go over. Now, who knows where each guy would be now had they played things out? I mean, look, maybe they'd be exactly where they are. You know, Barrett's not even in the company anymore. Ryback is gone, although they at least tried with him. Slater is still around. Otunga's not even wrestling anymore. Gabriel's gone. Tarver's gone. Darren Young is gone. I'm not even counting Daniel Bryan because he was out of the group after night one. So I'm not even including him in that. But even if just for a few more months, because I'm sure they would have found some other way to fuck this up. Even if just for another 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, whatever it is, they could have had something special with these guys. They killed off the hottest thing they had going in years. Way too soon. The Nexus should have gone over that night at SummerSlam. We are counting down the top 10 matches in SummerSlam history on our way to SummerSlam in Toronto on August 11th, and we find ourselves at number 6 on the list. 1995 was not a great year for WWE. I don't think it was a great year for wrestling in America anyway, just business-wise, in general. It was a year that gave us Diesel as the world champion, Mabel as the King of the Ring, and a never-ending cycle of gimmicks that included the likes of Isaac Yankem, who was Jerry Lawler's evil dentist, Jean-Pierre Lafitte, the fighting pirate who feuded with Bret Hart after stealing Bret's ring jacket, Santa Claus, an evil version of Santa Claus from the South Pole, and Mantar. Need I say more? One gem that year, and to be fair, there was more than one match-wise. I mean, Bret Hart and Hakushi had a great match at one of the In Your House shows. Shawn Michaels and Jeff Jarrett. Bret Hart and the British Bulldog at the end of the year in your house where Bret bladed. He bled all over the place. That was a great match. But standing tall above all the rest was a rematch of one of the greatest matches of all time. And a match that was never even supposed to take place. Shawn Michaels defending the Intercontinental title against Razor Ramon in a ladder match at SummerSlam 1995. That clocks in at number 6 in the countdown. Their WrestleMania 10 match is a classic. It was way more influential in turning a lot of, I think, little wrestling fans probably into wrestlers later in life. But I enjoyed this match more. I actually like this ladder match, the rematch, a little bit better than I did the match at WrestleMania 10. And unlike the first one, both guys here were babyfaces coming into this match. Shawn was the champion. Razor was the challenger. In the first match, Shawn had a title, although he wasn't the champion. Razor was. But here they were both babyfaces, and it was not the originally scheduled match on this show. It had already been announced as Shawn Michaels defending the Intercontinental title against Psycho Sid. Michaels had just won the title the month before from Jeff Jarrett, and he was going to defend the championship against Sid. Sid had come back earlier that year as the bodyguard for Shawn, going into WrestleMania 11 in his match with Diesel, which Shawn lost. So the next night on TV, Shawn gave Sid the night off because he kind of blamed him in part. There was like a distraction, as I remember, in that match, and he was going to give Sid the night off. Big Sid, I'm giving you the night off. And that set Sid off. He turned on Shawn. He gave him 3 power bombs, and Shawn got carted off, and Diesel came out to make the save, even though the two of them had been, you know, bitter enemies. So when Michaels came back, you know, 5-6 weeks later, whatever it was, he was a babyface, and he had reconciled with Diesel. So it was going to be Shawn and Sid at SummerSlam. That was the plan. So why did they change the match? They were coming off a string of terrible pay-per-views. King of the Ring 95 is one of the worst WWE pay-per-views of all time. Not the worst, but one of the worst that they have ever produced. It got widespread negative reviews for good reason. And the In Your House show the next month really wasn't that much better. You know, the only saving grace really was the match between Shawn Michaels and Jeff Jarrett. And Jarrett and Rhodey literally walked out of the show right after that match was over. They were supposed to shoot an angle after the match where they teased Ascension because the Rhodey had accidentally tripped Jeff Jarrett during the match and that led to him losing. So they were going to build to a split and they were going to end up doing a match between them at SummerSlam. But they were very upset because they felt like the angle was being rushed way too fast. You know, on that same In Your House show earlier in the night, that was the night that Jarrett did the whole lip sync to With My Baby Tonight. Although we didn't know at the time that it was a lip sync job. That big reveal had not yet been made. And they just felt, you're rushing this way too fast. You know, we shouldn't be splitting up just yet and having a match. And they were just very, creatively, they were just on different wavelengths. And so they walked out when the match was over. So 2 bad shows. And WWE was looking at what on paper was probably going to be number 3. They felt they just had to put something on the show to help draw interest. Diesel and Mabel in the main event and Bret Hart against Isaac Yankem, I guess, was not going to cut it for a big show like SummerSlam. So they made the call to do the rematch of one of the most famous matches in company history. Razor Ramon did not even have a match before this on that show. He wasn't even scheduled to be on the SummerSlam card. So they positioned the change on TV as Gorilla Monsoon, who at the time was the new interim acting president, the figurehead president like Jack Tunney used to be on WWE television. He's the interim acting president of the World Wrestling Federation, and he's going to be fan-friendly. And so I guess he's being fan-friendly here by sparing us a shitty match for one that we might actually like. And instead, Sid would get his title match, but he would wrestle the winner of the ladder match for the championship on the September 11th episode of Monday Night Raw. So it gave them a title match to promote for what was being billed as the season premiere of Monday Night Raw. So that was how we got to this point, just to give some context to all this. Michael Hayes joins Vince McMahon on commentary. This was he was doing his Doc Hendricks shtick at the time. This is because Jerry Lawler had left the announce booth earlier with Isaac Yankem after their beatdown of Bret Hart, the root canal gone bad. And, you know, as far as Hayes in this spot, he could be a little grating on the nerves, but when you go back and listen to some of these announce teams compared to some of the announcing we get today, I would gladly take a Vince McMahon, Doc Hendricks announce team on TV. So right off, before the match even starts, it looks like the title is positioned way too high in the air. You can see Razor Ramon, they pick him up on camera, he's mouthing to the referee to fucking bring it down. Vince McMahon on commentary says you'd have to be Andre the Giant and have a jetpack on your back to grab that thing. I actually don't think it was a matter of it being suspended too high. I think what they were calling to bring the belt down for is that when the referee hooked the title to the cable and they raised it up into the air, it was positioned flat. So the main plate of the title was facing down. If you watch most ladder matches, the title is positioned sideways. So it hangs down longer, which makes it easier to grab onto. I think that was the issue. Because as soon as they lowered that title, the referee went to go over to fix it. Michaels, who of course was just, he was Shawn Michaels. So he shoves the referee out of the way, basically saying, you know, piss off, I'll do this myself since you can't do your job. And all he did was he grabbed the belt and he just repositioned it. And then he just shouted, up, bring it back up. And so we had quite the start here to this match before we even got underway. So the match finally starts. We've got a feeling out process between the two of them here. Michaels takes the Harley Race corner bump, which younger fans probably would call the Triple H bump in the corner, out over the top to the floor. Michaels, the very next spot that they do, Michaels gets back in the ring and Razor's outside on the apron. And Michaels is going to suplex Razor Ramon back inside. He goes to suplex him once, he can't get him up. He goes to suplex him a second time, he can't get him up. He realizes at this point, oh shit, because he actually shouts, oh shit, as Razor goes to suplex him. And he suplex Shawn Michaels out of the ring to the floor. Michaels' boot on the way down catches the railing. He took the full brunt of this fall on his, basically his lower back and his tailbone. I mean, Razor, this wasn't just a suplex out of the ring. I mean, this was Razor got him high, like vertically, high in the air, and just sort of let go. So if you can picture it, he gets him up vertical, and he just starts to let go. And Michaels had a long way to fall. I mean, this was just a brutal spot. So Razor is the first one to the ladder. He's bringing it into the ring. Shawn goes for a baseball slide, which if you remember, he hit that move in their first match at WrestleMania 10. There was a spot in the match where Shawn did a baseball slide and he knocked the ladder back into Razor's ribs. So they were playing off that here, only this time Razor, he had this scouted. He moves out of the way. Shawn's on the floor, turns around, gets cold cocked with a right hand. Spit goes flying everywhere. Scott Hall, I have to say this, Scott Hall has to have one of the best looking, best sounding punches in all of wrestling. Then, now, and forever. Jerry Lawler was the master of it. I think if you ask a lot of fans, like especially older fans, like who do you think had the best punch? Who threw the best punch in wrestling? At least here in America. Jerry Lawler is going to be number one on a lot of people's list. And rightfully so. He was just so good at it. Bret Hart was another one. Bret Hart also, I think, threw a very believable punch. Steve Austin and Scott Hall is right up there with him. And actually, you know what? You know who throws a great punch today in WWE? Roman Reigns. And I'm not talking about the silly Superman punch. Just like a thrust, like a punch. Roman Reigns actually throws a very believable looking, sounding punch, which I could appreciate this because we had so many years of John Cena. For all the great matches that he did have, and I think he gets shit on a lot, probably, you know, unfairly, but the guy couldn't throw a punch to save his life. Maybe in real life he could deck somebody and throw a punch, but like throwing a worked punch, for as long as he was doing it for and as like prominent a star as he was, you would think he would get better at it, but my God. So it makes me appreciate like a Roman Reigns when I see somebody throw a good punch. And I would say that the person selling it has as much to do with it as anything. But I just appreciate the ones who make it look as realistic as possible. Razor tries to climb the ladder. Sean snuffs out that attempt. He grabs the ladder. He's going to go to position it. But in grabbing the ladder and trying to maneuver it around, he accidentally hits Razor Ramon with it. And he kind of passes it off like he didn't really mean to do it, but like, oh well. And he sets the ladder up and he starts to climb. And as he starts, Razor reaches up and he yanks down Sean's tights to expose his bare ass. Although, thankfully, it was not on the hard camera side. So we didn't get to see it, but we could hear all the little girls in the crowd and all the women screaming and shouting, and so obviously he pulled his pants down. And that's also playing off their WrestleMania 10 match. They did the same spot. Unfortunately, there we did get to see more of Shawn Michaels than we would have liked to. Razor then knocks the ladder over. Sean gets his knee wrenched in the ladder on the way down, which looked very nasty. And that would be the story of the match, Razor working over Sean's knee, which is twofold. It prevents him from throwing the super kick, and it prevents him from climbing the ladder. Or at least it makes it harder for him to do so. In their first match, it was Sean working over Razor's ribs with shots with the ladder. Here, Razor worked almost like a heel, and it was Shawn Michaels selling the body part. Or kind of. You know, for a guy whose knee was mangled, he sure did fight through the pain and hit a bunch of high spots later, off the ladder. I guess you could chalk it up to adrenaline. Unlike Vince McMahon, playing it up like he, you know, did he or did he not mean to hit Razor with the ladder, you know, earlier. Razor, there was no ambiguity about Razor Ramon here in this match and what he was trying to do. He was using this ladder as a weapon to torture Shawn Michaels. He was targeting the knee. Vince McMahon was trying his damnedest to make you wonder if it was on purpose or not. He's like, well, that looked intentional. I'm like, yeah, no shit, that looked intentional. You could stop pretending. It's very obvious that he meant to do it. Stop trying to convince us that he's not. Razor climbing the ladder. Shawn gives him a back suplex off the ladder. Michaels then sets the ladder up in the corner and he catches Razor coming off the top of the ladder with a moonsault. Michaels then climbs back up the ladder to the very top. The very top rung of the ladder. He does the sign of the cross. And this is before he found Jesus. Does the sign of the cross. And before his feet even left the steel, Razor had already started rolling out of the way. There was nothing he could do. He was already in mid-flight. And he crashed and he burned. And they both get back up eventually. They climb the ladder on opposite sides. The ladder tips over and they crotch themselves on the top rope. Both men now are out on the floor. Razor is fishing around underneath the ring. He's trying to find something. And finally, he pulls out a second ladder. And this may have been, I believe this was the first time that we had two ladders introduced into a single ladder match in WWE. Now, these days, if you have less than five ladders in a match, it's considered a letdown. But the simplicity is, I think, what is so great about these older matches, right? And just the way that people react to it, it was just such a simpler time, I guess. Michael starts climbing before Razor can set up the second ladder. So Razor says, the hell with this. He drops the ladder. He walks over. He grabs Shawn Michaels underneath the armpits in the position for a Razor's Edge off the ladder, and he delivers the Razor's Edge. And if this is a regular match, it's over. But it's not. And Razor just takes forever to get back to his feet. Because the Razor's Edge is a move that was always protected. I don't think I ever saw anybody get hit with that move in WWE or in WCW. Unless there was then this delay of 60 seconds, I never once, ever, saw Scott Hall hit that move and crawl over for the pin and not get the pin. So they protected that move everywhere he went. But no pinfalls in this match. So now both guys are down. Razor, again, he takes forever to get back up to his feet. He sets up the second ladder finally, because the first one was tipped over by Sean. And so he's got the ladder upright, and he's climbing, and Sean now is climbing the other ladder. He got the other ladder upright, and he's climbing, and Shawn delivers from one ladder to the other. He delivers a glancing super kick. It barely grazed him, but he hit a super kick to Razor and knocks him off the ladder. But Shawn's ladder is not directly underneath the championship. So he looks up and he kind of surveys things and he leaps. He leaps off the ladder. He tries to grab the title, but he whiffs. And he crashes to the mat. And now when I watch this back, I'm almost positive that was supposed to be the finish. I think the super kick off the ladder was supposed to be the finish of this match. But the ladder was just not positioned in the right place, and he jumped and he missed. So they don't skip a beat. Razor, he gets up, and he tries for a Razor's Edge. He's close to the rope, so you know he's going to get backdropped. And sure enough, he gets backdropped out to the floor. Huge backdrop bump out to the floor, and that is it. He is done. He is done. But again, the ladder is not in the right position. And I don't know why he did not bother moving the ladder. But Shawn Michaels, instead of moving it, just starts climbing. So he climbs the ladder and he looks up and he reaches up and he grabs the title. But as he's grabbing the title, he's falling off the ladder. So he just lets the ladder go. And he, with both hands, grabs onto this title and tries to pull it down. And it doesn't come off. The title does not come down with him. He loses his grip, he falls to the mat, and the title is still just hanging in the air, swaying back and forth. And he pulled on that thing good, and it just didn't unhook. So they show a fan sitting in the audience, and he's got this look on his face, like all dumbfounded, like what the hell's going on here? What's going on is that it's the second time that they tried to end the match, and Shawn botched the finish. I think that was the second botched finish, not the first. I think they botched it twice because the belt, it's just out of position. You know, blame whoever you want to. Blame Shawn, I guess. He could have moved the ladder over and he opted not to that second time. So you can imagine now, after what may have been the second botch of this finish, you can just imagine Shawn Michaels. This is Shawn Michaels in 1995. His reaction to all of this. He did not react well when things did not go his way. And here he threw a temper tantrum, and he starts angrily tossing ladders around. Finally, he tries for a third time, and the third time is the charm. He retrieves the championship. He wins the match. Razor comes inside. He snatches the belt away from him. He teases that he's going to whack him with the belt, but instead he hands it to him. He shakes his hand, and the two embrace. I really don't think the botched finish takes away from anything. Shawn pitching a fit is, you know, it's par for the course with him back then. Two SummerSlams in a row where he did that. Actually, he did it at WrestleMania that year too. He took the Harley Race bump in the corner out over the top rope, and he landed on top of one of the photographers that were at ringside that night, because they had a boatload of photographers all around the ring, because that was the night that Lawrence Taylor was wrestling Bam Bam Bigelow in the main event. So there was a lot of press there. So Michaels takes this bump out of the corner, out to the floor, and he lands on top of one of the photographers. And, you know, he landed on the guy, and it's not the guy's fault necessarily, because they had the authority to be ringside and to shoot the photographs. It's not like today where they have a pit area and they don't allow photographers anymore at ringside, which I actually think takes away from it a little bit, because, I don't know, there's just something about seeing the photographers all over the ringside area. You don't see that in WWE anymore. They kind of keep them herded together in this pit, which actually, when I interviewed George Napolitano many years ago, who's one of the prolific, you know, wrestling photographers, and I'm happy to call him a friend. I mean, he's a great guy, and we actually talk quite a bit, and I see him. He shoots other events and stuff, but I interviewed him on the podcast many years ago. I think it was episode 82, and talked about that. I said, well, how did you feel when they took the photographers away from ringside and they moved you guys into the pit area? And I was shocked by his answer. I thought his answer would be, well, you know, I'm not really a fan of it, or I liked it better when I had the freedom to kind of just roam free and get my shot in whatever position I wanted to be in. He said he loved it. He said it was great because they eliminated all the work for him. Now he just has to stay in one area. He doesn't have to move around and worry about, you know, elbowing people out of the way to get, you know, prime positions. So it was fascinating to hear him talk about that. But Shawn lands on this guy, and instead of just ignoring it and getting back into the ring or even checking on him maybe to see if he's okay, no, what does he do? He reaches down and he grabs this guy and he literally drags him across the floor. So that was a WrestleMania that same year. So then this outburst at SummerSlam. Fast forward a year to SummerSlam 96, he's wrestling Vader. Shawn's coming off the top rope. The plan is that he's going to come off the top with an elbow, but Vader's going to roll out of the way. Shawn's going to land on his feet, and then he's just going to drop a standing elbow on Vader. That's the spot. Instead, Vader didn't move. So Shawn lands on his feet. He looks like an idiot. And he kicks this guy in the head. He stomped on Vader's head as hard as he possibly could. Twice, he stomped on his head, and then he yells, "Move!" He just yells at him as loud as he possibly could. That was Shawn Michaels. That was Shawn Michaels. That was mid-90s Shawn Michaels. So he would go on to successfully defend his championship against Sid on Raw 2 weeks later, since Raw was preempted for tennis the night after SummerSlam. That's why they waited 2 weeks to do the match. And it just reminds me, it takes me back to those days of preemptions for U.S. Open tennis and the Westminster Dog Show. Oh yeah, fun times. Fun times those preemptions were. Because Raw was preempted, over on TNT, WCW debuted a new show, you may have heard of it, called Monday Nitro. In fact, I would not be surprised to find out that Eric Bischoff scheduled it that way on purpose, knowing that Raw would not be on the air, and they would run unopposed. It's smart. It's the smart thing to do. So the first head-to-head battle between Raw and Nitro really didn't happen until that September 11th show, and that show was headlined by Shawn Michaels against Psycho Sid, and Eric Bischoff, in a move that he would continue doing, decided to spoil the outcome of the match on his show before it even aired on USA, because Raw was a taped show, and Bischoff told people, don't bother channel surfing because the other show was taped 2 weeks ago, and Shawn Michaels pins the big guy with a super kick. Actually, he pinned him after three super kicks. But that was the sort of thing that Bischoff resorted to doing, which as a WWF fan at the time, when I would put Nitro on, pissed me off to no end. I can see why Jerry Lawler said Vince McMahon used to wish death on Eric Bischoff. Now he's bringing him back to run SmackDown. Talk about what a difference 25 years makes. I wonder if Bischoff will, one of the new Bischoff edicts will be whenever SmackDown goes on the air, he'll give away the NXT results. So Michaels and Sid, they did go on to have what I remember being a much better match at the Survivor Series the following year at Madison Square Garden, which was night and day in terms of crowd support. My words cannot do justice to how over Sid was when he came back in 96. He just looked the part. He looked like if you were going to build a professional wrestler, it would look like Psycho Sid. He just looked cool. He was charismatic in his own way. He didn't have to be a fancy wrestler like Shawn Michaels. He got over on his size and his charisma. Not so much when he was with Ted DiBiase in 95. But when he came back, oof, he was over like nobody's business. So that's the number six entry in the countdown for this week. Next week, we are down to the top five. The number five entry is next week, so we're getting down to the nitty-gritty soon enough. I love saying that, nitty-gritty. You know where I got that from? Gorilla Monsoon. There's just some expressions that I kept from my younger years as a wrestling, like the solar plexus. How the hell would I know what a solar plexus is if I didn't watch WWF television at the time? I heard it from Gorilla Monsoon. That's where I get all my medical knowledge from. I got it from Gorilla Monsoon. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. And also, if you want to get money off your very first ride, there we go, 2.5 hours. Your very first ride with Lyft. If you don't want to take Uber, I've got Lyft and Uber on my phone. It's always good to have options. Sign up for a Lyft account. Use the code Solomonster, and you can get money off your first ride. You might even be able to get your first ride for free. So again, the code is still active. The code is Solomonster. I will be back for episode 608 next weekend. That's going to be a busy weekend because next Saturday we've got WWE airing an Evolve show live on the network for the very first time. It's got Adam Cole defending the NXT title against Akira Tozawa and Drew Gulak wrestling Matt Riddle. And there could be more NXT influence on the show as well, but that's airing live on the network. At the same time, AEW is going to be streaming for free its Fight for the Fallen show. So I think what I'll probably do is watch that live, and then I'll go back and watch some of the Evolve stuff later. But I also think there's a G1 show for New Japan that night, I believe. Or maybe that morning. So there's a lot of wrestling next Saturday. And then Sunday is Extreme Rules. So there is a pay-per-view next weekend. I'll try to get predictions up a few days early if I can. Probably do a live stream when the pay-per-view is over. But we'll get into all that. It's going to be a very busy weekend next weekend. What is it not busy? What was the last show I did that was under 2 hours? And I still have people who want me to review Impact and MLW and ROH. Am I finding time for all of this? But I love it. I will see you guys back here next weekend. Again, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. And we'll be back next weekend with more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Should WrestleMania be expanded to 2 days? Is it time for a 2-day WrestleMania? Fuck no, that's not what needs to be done. We didn't need a 2-day WrestleMania the first 30 years. We sure as fuck don't need one now.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, and more.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.